Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. If I could remind people to turn off their phones, Blackberries, and other types of instruments, that'd be great. Unless you're a first responder and need to have yours on. Of course, that doesn't go for Representative Matthews. We have a pretty full agenda today, so I just want to kind of lay out where we're going to go. I'm going to try to get to everything. I may jump around a little bit depending on the sign-up sheets. But we're going to start out with a work session on House Bill 2365, and then we will go to public hearing on House Bill 2188 right after that. There will be no work sessions on any of the other bills that are listed as public hearing and possible work sessions. We will commence to have public hearings on those other bills after we deal with the first two on our agenda. So with that, I believe I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2365. And Victoria, would you like to give us a summary of this bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2365 prohibits the sale, distribution, import, or manufacture for sale in Oregon of novelty lighters, creates civil penalties for violations, authorizes the state fire marshal to define novelty lighter by rule, and to create and maintain a list of products meeting the definition, allows the state fire marshal or a designated representative to conduct inspections to ensure compliance, to seize and destroy listed products, and to request the Attorney General to seek injunctive relief, declares an emergency effective on passage with a 90-day moratorium on seizures.
Thank you. And if I could get the State Fire Marshal's office, or whoever would like to come up from their office would be great. One, two, or three of you. That was sort of a hint.
Thank you. It's much better to have company than be alone.
I recognize that. So anyway, I appreciate you coming forward again on this bill. I just wanted you at the up here at the podium just in case we had questions from the committee. I have not received any communications from anybody that there was opposition to this bill. I guess we had a pretty good hearing on this. I think the case was laid out, I think, pretty well for us. And I am probably going to give you an opportunity to say something at this point. But it is our intention to go ahead and move this bill today. So if you'd like to make comments about the bill or any statements you'd like to make, I'm giving you that opportunity.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Randy Simpson, Acting State Fire Marshal. From the Office of State Fire Marshal, first and foremost, I want to thank you for all your time and effort into this bill. And secondly, there was a comment that on the penalties during the testimony that money would go back into our office to be moved toward fire prevention. Just for the record and to make sure it's clear to every member of the committee is that any funds we receive into our fire service under this program, our mission is to save lives, property, and the environment from fires and hazardous material events. So all of our money that we do collect on any civil penalties will go toward prevention. That is our number one goal of our agency. So,
thank you for that clarification. Committee members, I want to give you an opportunity to ask the Fire Marshal any questions. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill talks about sale, distribution, import, manufacture, and for sale. But simply possessing wouldn't be a violation, or a collector who had a large collection of these items wouldn't be in violation just for possessing.
Do you want to address?
That's correct, Representative, or I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That is correct, that simple possession would not be a violation. We know, in fact, there are people that have significant collections. This would just make it more difficult for them to grow those collections here in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. And with that, I'd like to entertain a motion to make this House Bill 2365, motion to move it to the floor. And I'd like to Representative Matthews a chance. He's expressed some passion about this bill for some reason, and so I'm going to let him have a chance of making that motion.
Well, I thank you, Chair Hovey. And yes, this is near and dear to my heart, and I appreciate all the effort that you made in your presentation the other day and the clear understanding that we all have. And so, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we would send House Bill 2365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Representative Matthews moves House Bill 2365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion to move House Bill 2365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation is adopted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all your hard work on this. And as I said before, I'm glad that we were able to move this quickly. I'm sorry that Oregon took so long to get here, but I hope we can do what we can to make sure this happens fast.
Thank you.
And I'll open up that work session real shortly to assign the carrier. Representative Matthews, I'd like you to carry this bill on the floor.
Absolutely honored. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2365. With that, I would like, I'm going to jump to House Bill 2268. I know I said I was going to 2188, but I'd like to do 2268 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2268 and call up the Attorney General's office. Keith Dubenovich, let me get it right one of these days, and Andrew Scholl.
Thank you, Chair Halby. It is indeed my pleasure. Keith Dubenovich, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Andrew Scholl with me to my right. I come to speak in favor of House Bill 2268. In essence, the goal of this bill is to protect consumers from unexpected auto repair bills and hopefully to reduce disputes between consumers and auto repair shops. And the bill essentially requires vehicle repair shops to provide a written estimate for vehicle repair costs. And then if the expected cost is going to exceed by 10% what the original estimate is, before the repair shop can proceed, they must obtain consent from the consumer. It also requires the auto repair shops to keep certain records so that there's no dispute about whether indeed they got consent from the consumer or not. Now, the reason for this bill is fairly simple. Among the inquiries and complaints that the Department of Justice gets, the complaints regarding motor vehicle repairs are quite substantial. We usually get about 100 a year. And many of these complaints might go to the quality of repairs and things of that sort, which are not impacted by this bill. A lot of the inquiries relate to concerns about, gee whiz, I didn't authorize that expense, or gee whiz, the auto repair shop wouldn't let my car go until I paid more than I had anticipated. And in our written testimony, we provide a couple of examples of complaints that we've received. Somebody takes a car in. They're led to believe that the repair would cost between $3,500 and $5,000. And when the work is done, the total is $6,500. Well, as you can imagine, in this day and age, with every dollar that's so valuable, a difference between $5,000 and $6,500 is quite substantial. So clearly the purpose of the bill is simply to reduce the number of disputes that occur between auto repair shops and consumers. And I can say from a personal perspective, a year ago I had surgery on a knee, and I got a very detailed written estimate from the doctor in the hospital. And if a doctor in a hospital can provide me an estimate on the repairs that take place in my knee, certainly an auto repair shop should be able to do the same. Now, this bill is not completely novel in the state of Oregon. There is already a requirement in Chapter 746 that auto body repairs and estimates for auto body repairs be provided to consumers. And many other states have similar provisions. I'm pleased to say that we are working with industry representatives. We recognize that there are some areas where this bill needs improvement and modification, and we are very optimistic that with further work we'll be able to present a bill that will meet the needs of both the business, because certainly they want to get paid for the work that they are doing, and the consumer who doesn't want to, at least wants to have the opportunity to consent for any repairs that are done to their automobiles. So unless the committee has any questions, we would that's our presentation for the day.
Thank you. And I'm probably going to dispel with the questions from the committee today on this particular bill. There's been some concerns raised about some of the things in this bill, and the DOJ is going to be working on bringing back a more consensus piece, perhaps, hopefully, that we can take a look at and discuss this bill further. And I appreciate you trying to work those details out as they became aware to my office as well as yours, I'm sure. So, and I don't have anybody else signed up to speak on this bill at this point. And I don't think I have any interest in hearing any more. I'd like to move on to another piece, and we'll talk about this at a future date. So with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2268.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to open up a... I'm driving my committee administrator crazy by jumping around, but I'd like to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2188. And if I could bring up David Tatman, please. Thank you, Mr. Tatman, and committee members. As you recall, this bill was carried over from Monday, where we had a pretty lengthy discussion about mortgage lending in the state of Oregon, and just barely got to touch on the... I don't even know if we opened a hearing on this bill.
No.
So this is our first public hearing on this, so probably not the last. But Mr. Tatman, if you identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I've just distributed some written testimony, and then I'll just speak off of that. As you just heard from the chair, we were in here Monday, and the director, Corey Streisinger, spent a great deal of time, as did a number of witnesses, explaining both what's gone on in the past couple of years with the mortgage lending industry, what specifically happened with the governor's work group over the past year or so, some of the accomplishments, some of the changes in the law, and then some of the recent changes we saw in the federal law. And we had a great deal of discussion during that work group about directions that we should be taking. And we were able to delay some events because we had the anticipation that the federal government was going to make changes. Well, in fact, the federal government has made significant changes in both the Truth in Lending, or Reg Z as it's known, and in RESPA, the Real Estate Settlement Protection Act. And those things have been much, in my opinion, to the benefit of consumers and borrowers. And so we think a lot of great strides have been taken in the last 6 months. And the package of information you received from Director Streisinger included a number of items, both examples of some of those changes in terms of the disclosure documentation and some of the other products that have been generated recently. So the purpose of my testimony today is to speak in support of House Bill 2188 and ask for the support of this committee. This is the outcome of the work group to some degree, and it also reflects some of the concerns we had for the federal work that maybe didn't go quite as far as we thought it should. So primarily there are three individual components within the bill. The first one addresses negative amortization loans. As my testimony points out, those are loans where the borrower is allowed to pay less than the principal and interest that is accruing each month. Therefore, the balance owed on the loan actually increases rather than decreases. Usually it's fairly complex and hard for people to get their arms around and fully understand. We have a number of concerns that there were a lot of abuses in this situation, and particularly where people had a teaser opportunity, if you will, to come in and get a low monthly payment at the short term and then have it repriced later and obtain that what's known as sticker shock to see what the new price is. We think that's caused a lot of problems for consumers. So our first proposal in Section 1 is to address negative amortization loans. And as I pointed out, Reg Z adopted a number of changes into the way that lending should take place. There's a requirement now that prepayment penalties cannot go beyond 2 years, that you have to make a determination by review of information documentation that a person can make the monthly payments of the loan in question, and that you have to determine at the highest price of that the loan will cost on a monthly basis that the person is in a position to pay that loan. So those are three changes that were made through Reg C to high price loans. Essentially, high price loans, I think, is another way of calling subprime loans. Many of these negative amortization loans were subprime loans, but not all. Therefore, we want to pick up those same protection for all negative amortization loans. So this bill addresses just that. It would ensure that people are qualified to pay for the loan at its highest rate. It will ensure that that there's been some review of documentation, so it isn't a low-doc, no-doc loan. And it also requires that prepayment penalties only exist for up to 2 years. And there's a provision that says a prepayment penalty in a loan cannot be exercised if the lender is the one who will be refinancing the loan. And these are all similar components that you saw or will see in the Reg Z model. It was done for the higher price loan. So we've used that kind of as our model for what we're doing in negative amortization. A couple other issues that came up, we heard that there are a number of people who both advertise or negotiate or at least solicit people in languages other than English. It's not at all unusual for people at social settings, particularly at church, if you will, to come up to people and start talking to them in their primary language about the potential obtaining a loan through the individual. If they are advertised in a secondary language or in a second language, or if the negotiation takes place in a second language, we believe that some fundamental documentation needs to be provided in a second language. So our bill proposes to provide just that for the three largest languages other than English, or the three languages that are used by the largest group of people in Oregon other than English, for both good faith estimate, of which you've got a copy in that packet I mentioned, and in the disclosures that Reg Z Truth in Lending now require. Now, the department feels strongly about this, and we will actually prepare these documents in these three languages. Currently, those languages would be Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese, of course, subject to change. The third component is something that came up during the work group, and that's the question of the fairness of people bringing lawsuits to enforce their private right of action under the mortgage lending law. As you know, a number of people bring these lawsuits, and many times they may feel somewhat reluctant to do that. As we know, the cost of bringing litigation is quite high, And the current law reads that an a party, at the discretion of the court, can be awarded attorney fees, both the plaintiff, which in most cases would be the borrower, or the defendant, which would be the lender. And we've heard that that's quite a disincentive for people to protect themselves or exercise their litigation rights in this situation. So what we propose to do is to come up with a method that would allow for attorney's fees to be imposed against a plaintiff if the plaintiff brings a lawsuit in bad faith or for purposes solely for harassment, and additionally, if a person doesn't choose to take this notice provision that we're proposing. And the notice provision essentially says you contact the borrower, excuse me, the lender. The borrower contacts the lender and notifies them what their concern is and also what the remedies they're seeking. This gives the lender and borrower the opportunity to come together, talk, hopefully negotiate a settlement short of litigation and the cost of litigation. But it would also say if they go through this good faith effort and give them the notification, then they would not be subject to the defendant receiving attorney fees. Only the plaintiff, if they prevailed and the court so chose, would receive the attorney fees. At the end of my testimony, there are a couple of places where we identify potential amendments, and two of them are just cleanups. On page 4, I mentioned that there's a phrase in section 2, page 1, that uses the word charter, and that would be a chartered mortgage lender. That's not a phrase we use in Oregon. It was a slip-up using federal language, and we're going to ask to have that stricken. We license, we don't charter, so we want to avoid that confusion. Secondly, the amendment, we would come back and ask to declare a different effective date than what's currently in the bill because it references RESPA and Truth in Lending, and those dates, although we thought they were certain, have been postponed. And so rather than get hung up in trying to estimate the date, we just want to say the effective date of RESPA and Truth in Lending, the recent changes. And lastly, as the committee may recall, you had a witness up here Monday who asked for some consideration about the implementation of Section 4 around the attorney fee issue, who said, as the bill currently reads, it would only impact those transactions, those loans that were made after the effective date of this bill. And, of course, the large volume of loans that are under subject to litigation right now and will be the vast number of loans that are being looked at have already taken place, and so this wouldn't have that impact. So it's our recommendation, and we would be proposing an amendment to say that this, that as of the effective date of this bill, anyone that brings a lawsuit regarding a loan would cover that loan rather than wait till just cover the loans that come in after the effective date of the bill. We think that would achieve the purpose of Section 4 of this bill. With that, I have nothing more to add. As I say, I would ask that the comments and the written testimony of the director on Monday as they pertain to this bill, 2188, be added to the record just so we have a complete legislative history. And other than that, I stand ready to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, and we'll let the record show that her testimony would be added to the record of this bill as it pertains. Questions from the committee at this time of Mr. Tatman? Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who will still be able to make these two types of loan that you described? In other words, those, who don't you regulate now that will still be able to make these loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, with respect to negative amortization loans, the various federal lenders will still be able to do just that. So federal banks, federal credit unions, and those that are subsidiary of federal banks. Consumer finance lenders are not subject to this bill. And so this, in fact, just flipping your question over, this would be limited to Oregon mortgage lenders and mortgage bankers. It doesn't address any of the other potential lenders in the state of Oregon.
Follow up?
No, I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, there's a record that we're not fixing everything and that it's going to have a somewhat of an unlevel playing field possibly, and I'd love to hear more discussion from those people who actually make those loans as to how they view it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you won't follow up, I guess I will. Why not?
Well, Mr. Chair, as you know, we do not have any regulatory authority over our federal banks, federal credit unions, and those who are subsidiary of federal banks. So that's first and foremost, why not? The other ones that are not in here essentially would be our state chartered banks and our state chartered credit unions. And for the most part, our state chartered banks do not engage in individual mortgage lending. The mortgage lending is mostly done, as we heard Monday, either through mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers or done through national organizations, the very large national banks and their subsidiaries. So we think we're addressing the vast majority of that. There is another category, which I just mentioned to Representative Krieger, and that is the consumer finance lenders. Our consumer finance lenders are licensed by us. They may engage in some of this activity. The decision was originally made that we were going to focus on the vast majority of those making the loans. But obviously it's a policy decision for this body if they wanted to go beyond that.
So I'll follow up with that again. And so the consumer lenders that are regulated by state do not fall under this, and yet some of them do make mortgage loans and do mortgage lending.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Although, again, many of them are the large national consumer lenders, the ones that Mr. Cosgrove may have identified either in this or other committees. If you will, there are a number under the Chase name and Wells Fargo and Citi. They all have these subsidiaries that engage in a lot of the non-traditional lending practices. And so many of them would not be within our jurisdiction. Some elect to be within our jurisdiction for a number of reasons that only they could best explain. So I would have to say that most of the consumer finance lenders that have to be licensed with us do not engage in a great deal of mortgage lending, but some do, to be honest.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman. I just want to make sure that I understand. So most of the complaints you've heard are made by the lenders that will be addressed in this bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I would say most of the complaints follow the number of individuals engaged in mortgage lending in general. The majority of the loans made in Oregon are made by our mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. And then the second largest group that makes loans are national organizations that we have no jurisdiction over. So if I could just maybe rate them, mortgage lenders, national organizations, and then the third at the bottom would be the consumer finance lenders.
Follow up? I'm still not clear. So the complaints that you've gotten over the last several years, would this bill cover most of those, the people who are making those loans?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tobin, yes, it would cover most of those. But again, it would not cover the complaints that we receive about national banks.
Got that. Thank you.
Representative Wagner.
Is this going to make it tough for the ones that banks that are under our jurisdiction to compete against the ones that are under the national jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, as it currently reads, it would not make it tough because banks aren't going to be subject to this. Again, I'd like to reiterate, most of our state banks don't engage in mortgage lending, that direct one-on-one transaction. Most of our banks are business banks and engage in lending for business purposes. They're the ones that engage in the development of housing in general, subdevelopments and alike. There may be a bank or two that engages in this. In fact, I heard a bank CEO yesterday say that he's from the coast, Newport, in fact, and he does do a fair amount of that lending. But that would be the exception, not the rule. But to get back to your original question, yes, as it reads right now, we're not putting any limitation on our state or banks or credit unions. So they would be in the same position as the national banks and credit unions.
One thing that I think needs to be clarified, the materials we have up here indicate that though we're prohibiting mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers from doing this, just want to clarify that the language we have basically says
without verifying the borrower's ability to repay. So if they verify that borrower's ability to repay, are they allowed to make these loans?
That, Mr. Chair, is one of the components of the bill. They have to verify. They also have to make a determination that they can afford this loan at its highest reset mark, and that could be the bigger challenge for them. And then lastly, there's that issue about prepayment penalties, which may or may not be a disincentive for them. I failed to mention that there are a number of exceptions for this, short bridge term or bridge loans for 18 months or less, reverse mortgages, HELOCs or home equity lines of credit, and all those similar to Regulation Z would be carved out. So there would be still permissible certain types of negative amortization loans. In fact, this bill does not propose to bar it currently. It just says there are certain limitations or certain procedures you have to go through before you can issue one.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that was clear. Further questions? Not seeing any right now. Mr. Tapman, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate your diligence and your stick-to-itiveness on these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, I'd like to have John McCulley.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, which is the organization of mortgage brokers in the state. And we have a contrary view to the one you just heard. We are opposed to House Bill 2188, and I'll try to go through some of the reasons for that opposition. First, as you heard on Monday, and you just heard again from Mr. Tapman, there are significant and massive changes hitting our profession. And we view bills like House Bill 2188 in the, I guess, football analogy, since the Super Bowl's coming up this weekend, as piling on. We are going to be working through some significant major changes and trying to comply with what is being requested of our small business people for a long time, and to add an additional layer of regulation at this time we don't think is appropriate. The second part, and the one that the committee I think was starting to address and did address with Mr. Tapman, is the fact that this only applies to a certain, and we believe, small portion of the lending community. It's important to understand, I think, that mortgage brokers are not lenders themselves. They aren't providing their own money. They are facilitating a transaction, and there is usually a bank or another organization behind it that is providing the money. And to say that by regulating just one entity that these products, your problems are, quote, going to be solved, I don't think is accurate. I have not seen data, Representative Tomei, that says what percentage of these loans come from certain entities. And I guess I would need to see that to know that loans originated by mortgage brokers, those potentially negative amortization loans from mortgage brokers, are indeed the majority. I haven't seen that data. Maybe it exists, but I would need to see that. We think that with the changes that have occurred over the past 18 months in our industry, that mortgage brokers may only be 25 to 35% of the market. They used to be more than that, but there, as you know, there are things happening internationally and that are affecting this industry. So I think that this bill, if you're going to act on it and impose these restrictions on the industry, it should be on everyone. And that is why we favor federal action in these areas. That's why we have supported what the federal government has done, both through regulation and through with congressional action and the passage of the SAFE Act, because their actions affect everyone. And everyone who is in this business comes under the same requirements. And we think that is the fairest way to approach it. Some specific parts of the bill. Negative amortization loans have had their place. There aren't, I can tell you right now, any being made as far as I know. But in times of low interest rates, which follow a high fixed interest rate period, high interest rate period, then a low interest rate period, these loans have been useful. We don't know if that's going to happen again, but that is at least one time. In certain instances, retirees have benefited from these types of loans, where a retiree with a limited income, a lower income, may want to stay in their family home a few more years, knowing they're going to sell it and downsize it. This loan, because of lower payments, may actually help them be able to fulfill that that opportunity. So there are certain circumstances where these loans have benefited consumers. And so I think it's important for the committee to look at establishing a policy that does restrict the consumer's ability to get loans that may actually benefit them, and with the proper restrictions that that would go with that. One of the other issues that confronts our folks is in the bill, where I think the chair was pointing out on page 2, starting at line 10, the mortgage banker or broker or loan originator negotiating, making, or offering to negotiate or make a negative amortization loan without regard to the borrower's repayment ability. The loan originator and the broker are kind of caught in a bind with this bill. This part of the bill would require the loan originator to be an underwriter, to evaluate that person's ability to repay, which is not the role of the loan originator. That is done by someone else who is in that business. I think the department, in their testimony on Monday, stated that the loan originator is the salesperson, and that, by and large, is the case. They are the salesperson. They are not loan underwriters. So they would not be able to do that. At the same time, under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, if this product is available, and if the loan originator knows the product is available, and if the customer wants this product, to avoid discrimination, the loan originator has to provide that product. So it puts the business in a very difficult position of having to serve or try to serve both, and I think it's an impossible position that the loan originator is being put in with those conflicting requirements. Let me go to the language issue now. As I was understanding and listening to Mr. Tatman's testimony, if my mortgage brokerage company has someone who speaks Portuguese, and they have a Brazilian customer, that the loan documents, as indicated here, would have to be in Portuguese, if they have indeed communicated with that borrower in Portuguese. Pick a language. I'm picking one other than the three main ones that the DCBS provides the materials. But that means that there could be a number of different languages that loan originators, the mortgage broker, is going to have forms for, which, of course, might be reasonable, except that most of these forms are generated through software systems. It's not the good old days where they're manually prepared and someone may have a sheath of forms, they go to the drawer and pull one out. They're developed and available through software systems. Software systems now, as I understand it, cover only Spanish speaking. So any form that is outside of that in the software is going to require some special investment, some change to the operating systems to allow those documents as required in the bill to be developed to meet the language requirement. And if it's anything beyond Spanish, Russian, or Vietnamese, I think as the department has testified, that is going to create some significant burdens for the small business. Mr. Chair, I've taken enough of your time. I know you have a lot of things, and so I'll conclude my testimony without talking about the attorney part of the bill, which we don't like either.
Well, at least you registered that. So I appreciate your comments, and you know, definitely I think these are important issues for the committee to consider. Questions from the committee for Mr. McGulley? I don't see any at this moment in time. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, I'd like to have Sybil Hebb.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center. I appreciate the committee's attention to this issue. I submitted written testimony that was fairly extensive at the hearing the other night, and so I want to just make the committee members aware of that, and I'll add just a few comments that I hope are responsive to some of the questions that have been raised thus far. We're supportive of the bill, House Bill 2188. We appreciate the steps that it takes to provide some further protection for consumers in Oregon. The federal regulations did make a good number of steps that are helpful to our clients, but we do think that there is room for state action and there's great need for state action, and so we appreciate the proposal that's part of the bill. We do think, however, that there are some gaps still left unaddressed by the bill, and we have encouraged and will continue to encourage the committee to consider some of those action, those steps for further action. I wanted to first speak to the bill itself and some of the questions that have been raised. I'll speak first to the language proposal because it's one that's particularly important to us. We represent low-income clients across Oregon. We're seeing a number of questions raised about loans that have been provided, and a number of those questions have come from consumers who do not speak English, whose language is other than English, and have, we think, been misrepresented into signing loans or maybe mistakenly led into signing loans that are contrary to their best interests and which they did not understand. The proposal that's in the bill that we think is really quite reasonable is that the requirements, the required disclosures will only be provided or only required to be translated if the business takes active steps to solicit the consumers, the customers that speak that language. And so the bill provides that there are three requirements that have to be met before the disclosure must be translated, and that is that the broker or originator communicates or causes to be communicated an advertisement that's in another language and or otherwise solicits the business in that other language, and on top of that, offers to negotiate or negotiates or makes the loan in the other language. And so those are significant steps that the business has to take in order to trigger the requirements that the disclosures be translated. And we think it's reasonable if a business is soliciting customers that they be prepared to follow through with language that the customers can understand. No requirement that the business has to solicit that those customers, but if they do, it's their choice, then that would be the requirement. So we do appreciate that, and we think it is a reasonably structured requirement, and we think it will be quite protective, the goal being that customers understand what it is that they're committing to, and we think that's good for all sides of the industry. We have appreciated the work group's good looks at the bill, and it's complementary bill, 2189, I think is the number. I do want to talk just about a few gaps that we see. I'll refer to them only briefly because they are fairly well, or I hope, outlined in my testimony. So I want to be respectful of the committee's time. We do think that the protections, the enhanced level of protections that are provided for in the bill towards negative amortization loans ought to be excluded or extended to other high-risk loans that are similarly complicated and potentially confusing for consumers. And so we would advocate that those higher evaluations apply to HELOCs and interest-only loans and other similar types of loans. We also would advocate that the protections apply to as many businesses as possible, basically, as many businesses offering these kinds of services to the extent that we are not preempted from doing so by federal law. We think that's the most protective measure for Oregon to take. And I think that that is the extent of the gaps that I wanted to identify, and otherwise I very much appreciate the protections that are provided. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hebb. Could you just go back for a minute when you were talking about other types of loans, other high-risk loans? You named HELOCs, and is there a definition of high-risk loans that you're using to, or I guess, referring to in when you refer to high-risk loans?
That's, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that's a good question. I don't have a specific definition. It's possible that others do. My concern has been that we look at the principles, which I think were sort of the theory that was behind the federal regulation of subprime loans. They looked at sort of which are the loans that are most confusing to consumers and most at risk of potential abuse. And so for those particular loans, the ones that we think have sort of drawn people in to agreements that are caused, you know, have then faltered and have caused such a negative impact on all of our communities. So for those loans, we want a closer look. And I think using that same theory, you could easily identify other types of loans, like negative amortization loans, that that would meet that same criteria. But I don't have a good definition is the answer to your question.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you about the language issue. And I think you bring up a good point. We don't want people preying on folks that don't understand. But I have the opposite reaction to the language thing, and I'm wondering what you think. Isn't it possible this could actually open up more confusion or the possibility of litigation when you try to trace back if there's a dispute over whether you provided, you were supposed to provide all the documents in their language, and then you get into who solicited who, or at what point did you become the, you know, you're selling them, at what point did you just walk through the door? All of that, to me, it's good theory, but it actually seems like it could be more confusing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, members of the committee, it's a good question, and unfortunately, I think we've had some time to look at this issue from the perspective of our clients. We have had a number of cases that have come in, and I actually asked the same question of one of our employees. We have a grant, a staff person who's funded to do assistance to homeowners struggling with foreclosures, and I asked her what she thought about that, and she showed me a section in the Yellow Pages where there were advertisements, you know, from, I couldn't read any of them because they were in Russian, this particular community, but, you know, there was a direct proof of a business's taking specific efforts to solicit customers in a particular language. And so it would be a question of fact at some level, but I think that there is evidence out there that I think could do a good job of proving that those elements had been met. So I hope that answers your question.
It's helpful. I have another question, if you'll let me.
Certainly, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there a question about that?
Pardon?
Me letting you ask another question.
Sometimes.
Okay.
As you are watching this, which obviously the Law Center is, what is your feeling on the federal fix so far? Is there enough time for us to understand if the federal government has made an impact on fixing some of this mess? Or, you know, you could probably tell by my question, I'm thinking some more dust needs to settle, but I'm interested in what you think.
Representative Gilliam, Chair Holvey, I think it's a good question. It is a complicated area. On the other hand, I think that people are going to go down while the dust is settling, and I think that the federal regulations have been based on some really good studies and good theories, and maybe we all need to revise as we go down the line. But the fact of the matter is that communities and families are suffering and losing their homes, and it's bringing our economy down, as we all know. So I think that I think they're good, sound proposals, and I think they're, in our opinion, based on our experience looking at the loans that we've seen, the steps that are proposed in the bill, and that we would advocate as further steps, would go a good distance towards creating some positive impact. So,
okay. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
With the cases that you've had come through, what's probably the percentage of English versus non-English speaking clients that you've had?
Chair Holvey, Representative Weiner, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I'm happy to look into that. You know, we have offices in communities across the state, and so in some communities, it's, you know, those clients are English speaking. In other communities, there are concentrations, as you know, in Oregon. It's spread out that way, so it would be higher in some offices than others, but I can look and see.
Because I would just kind of be curious to know where we're sitting
sure.
on that aspect.
Sure.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any other questions at this point. I appreciate your involvement in this issue and your testimony today. Thank you. I'd like to call David Tatman back up just briefly, if I could. Thank you. I suppose you identify yourself again for the record, but my question is, essentially, can you clarify what documents have to be translated, at least in your interpretation of the bill as written?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, for the record, David Tatman with the Department of Consumer Business Services. And, Mr. Chair, you must be a mind reader, because I was concerned that there was a fair amount of uncertainty, and I take responsibility for not making clear what the English and the translation of English written documents would require. Just two things, and they're these two documents: the good faith estimate, and that's the good faith estimate. You've got a copy of that in your packet that you got on Monday, and this is an example of the new truth in lending disclosure statement. Those are the only two documents that we're asking to be put into a secondary language. All the loan information, all the closing documents, the legal documents, all that will be in English. The third thing that we request, if you're going to do this negotiation in a separate language, is that you notify the applicant slash borrower that it would be in his or her best interest to bring somebody that can help them understand the rest of the transaction. So, in other words, bring your own translator. We're not requiring them to supply a translator. We're not saying it's mandatory. We're not asking that they file that they understood. We've just said these two documents, which are the fundamental building blocks for people to try and make a decision, should be in the native tongue that's being used for the negotiation, not the rest of the documentation that goes into the loan.
So let me finish this, and I'll move on to another question from somebody else. But so those are the two pieces. But under the bill, they only have to do that if under Section 3, Section 1, if those A and B elements are met. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. A being advertising or soliciting business. In other words, the proactive person is the business taking the initiative. And two, then offers a negotiator or does in fact negotiate a substantial portion of the communication in a second language. So those two are the trigger points. And again, it just requires those two documents.
In whatever language that happened to be.
Correct.
Okay. Right, Representative Riley, question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted you to address the Portuguese issue. How do we get those two documents in Portuguese?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I think that is, honestly, it's a business decision that the individual lender makes, that if they want to negotiate in Portuguese, or a substantial portion of it in Portuguese, because both parties feel more comfortable with that, then that's a decision they have to make, that they would have to translate the good faith estimate and the disclosure document.
Follow up. Thank you. And would your office then verify that that's happened, that this is a good translation in Portuguese, or how would we know that that's the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, great question. Obviously, we don't have a number of language experts. Mm-hmm. When we go out and do an exam, we will go through the file and determine if that document was in there. Presumably, if we got a complaint, and it's a complaint from the borrower saying, I was misled, then we'd go back and ask an expert to give us that information. There's a lot of gray area in that. Potentially, somebody could say this wasn't appropriate translation. Someone else would say it isn't. That's the risk. But most of the time, we feel like that won't be the problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Tim Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you be open amending this so it said we're only asking for two documents? And what do you think about the possibility of the department providing templates of the two documents in a wider range? I don't know what that means. Four more languages, two more languages. And if so, would that be at great expense to the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, of course, we're open to discussion about amending the bill. We think this is a good bill, and we certainly wouldn't want to get hung up on the rocks of the technical point. So we are open for further discussions in that. The three languages we identified, we think, represent the vast majority of those speaking other than not English speakers in Oregon. So we'd want to do some analysis, determine how many transactions or how many people are using alternative languages. I mean, if there's less than 0.1% that's engaged in negotiating things in this language, it may not behoove us to do that. I think we have at our through the state of Oregon, we have translators of a number of foreign languages. Last count, I think, was over 75. So our ability to take a look at translating down a number of different foreign languages may be something we could do. There's probably a point of diminishing returns. I'm not sure where that is right now, but we're certainly open to that discussion. I do think that the bill is, I believe, and I could be wrong, I'm certainly open to the suggestions, I believe it's pretty clear that it's those two documents. Now, reading Section 3, Subsection 2, A and B, it may be a little hard to understand what those two documents are, and Representative Riley might say plain language would be very beneficial here, but as we know, to identify something that's in the federal law, we have to be fairly careful in how we identify it. But those A and B, I have done some research, and I've asked staff to do that. As I showed you the two documents, those are what A and B cover. And I believe that's all that we're asking for, other than that statement that you should bring your own translator.
So what about C?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we go in and do an examination, we find that C wasn't in the file, we'd have some significant concerns. But again, I think it's just a bare statement. I'm assuming that most businesses are capable of preparing that. We could step in and do that also if so requested.
I guess my question was that it appears to me, maybe I'm not reading this right, that the document identified in C would also, under this bill, have to be communicated. So there'd be three documents.
Correct, Mr. Chair. That's correct. That third piece is not a loan document. It's a statement that says you're hereby advised to bring a translator with you.
Right. But it would have to be provided in the foreign language. So there'd be three documents under this.
That's right.
Okay. Just want to make sure of that. Representative Wagner.
rather than putting the burden on the mortgage brokers to have to supply this in the three different languages, wouldn't it be easier for us to just do something where if they're going to solicit the business in Spanish or Russian or whatever, where the person has to bring in an interpreter with them that can interpret the documents for them, and then they can explain it to them? Because lots of times when you're going through, you don't read the documents anyway. A lot of it's educational process of owning a home, you know, after you've been through it or after you've been burned once. So I've done negative amortization loans myself because the interest rate was high and I knew it was going to be coming down over a period of time, so I would do a 7-year loan and then wait and refinance at the end of that time. People aren't going to read that and know that. We need to explain it to them at the time when they're taking out this loan, and this doesn't really take care of that problem. You can put it all in Spanish for them, but they're still not going to know what they're buying if they don't sit down and read it. So I wonder if we should make it, if they're soliciting that kind of business, they need to bring in an interpreter that can communicate with them their own language, but explain it clearly to them and address this problem that way, rather than making a whole industry suffer with a complex bill like this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, your point is well taken. If you choose to use a language other than English, it makes sense that you should have somebody there to assist you with the hard documents. I do think, though, that the two documents that we're focusing on, the good faith estimate and the required one-page disclosures, are the fundamental pieces of paper that most consumers are going to take when they go shopping, that they're going to look at this and they want it. And it's designed, that good faith estimate, the new good faith estimate, is designed to be used as you go from broker to broker. And rather than have someone there to translate the document, we think it makes more sense to have it in the native language, assuming they're using that native language. So they've got that there, and they can make that decision for themselves, either back at home or when they go down the road to another borrower, and so they compare offer A to offer B. That's why we're limiting it just to those two documents. I mean, if we were saying you had to have all the loan documents in this second language, that would be incredibly burdensome, and as you point out, probably would serve little purpose because most people don't read those. But the good faith estimate, we believe that is much like the manufacturer dealer's sheet on the car. That's where you start. You can compare the prices between A and B, and without that in your native tongue, I think you're going to be challenged.
Thank you. Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tamman, I just want to make sure that I understand. So this would not be required of all brokers, correct? It would just be required of those who advertise in another language. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that's correct. If they advertise in a language or if they go out and solicit, you know, you could develop relationships at service clubs or, as I mentioned, we've heard about church. We'll engage in solicitation at church. It's not an advertisement per se, but they're essentially engaged in developing a business. And we use the word and between sections A and B. They then negotiate a substantial portion of the transaction that way. If you only advertise in, let's say, Spanish, and then your negotiations are purely in English, well, that's a different circumstance. But where you lead someone to believe we're going to be doing this in a language that you understand, and so you don't need to be forewarned that all of a sudden you're going to need some assistance here, we think that's where the challenge is. If you engage entirely in the negotiations in English, then that person has to protect themselves by bringing in a translator. It's only when you, I think, if you will, lull people into thinking this will be something they could understand on their own or intuitively because they speak the language.
I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, if I may, I just want to make sure that I absolutely understand this. So if a broker communicates only in English, only advertises in English, only solicits business in English, they don't have to worry about that part of the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that's correct.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any at this point in time, perhaps in the future. We'll have more questions for you. I appreciate your testimony again. Thank you very much. Colleagues, I'm sure this bill will come back before this committee in the form of a public hearing again, and I appreciate that those that do have specific concerns with this bill will communicate them to the members of this committee.
that would be helpful for us to deal with this issue. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2188. And next, I would like to open a public hearing on 2190. As I look for it here. And I'd like to bring up from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Teresa Miller and company, if you wish, or not.
I'll see if I can do it by myself.
Yes, Victoria, would you give us a brief summary of the bill?
I would be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2190 requires insurer to provide written documentation to support valuation when vehicle is declared a total loss, requires insurer to pay amount not in dispute when there is a disagreement over the value of the totaled vehicle, and allows owner of totaled vehicle to recover reasonable appraisal costs from insurer when appraised value is greater than insurer's final offer.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I am the acting administrator at the Insurance Division, which is also within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 2190. Which requires insurers to provide more information to owners of motor vehicles that have been declared a total loss or totaled, and also offers greater consumer protection when insurers and vehicle owners disagree over the value of a totaled vehicle. Before I get into the specifics of the bill any further, I just want to give the committee a little bit of background about this issue. Historically, the Insurance Division receives significantly more consumer complaints and inquiries related to total loss issues than any other insurance-related issue. And we think that's probably the case for a couple of reasons. First, some insurers don't adequately explain to consumers the total loss process and the vehicle valuation process. And secondly, I think it's also just notoriously difficult to value motor vehicles given the number of variables that impact the value of a vehicle. And you add to that, or those problems, the fact that consumers who are faced with a total loss are also looking at the potential of not having their vehicle, not having transportation for a significant period of time. So you look at these circumstances, consumers really are at a disadvantage when they're faced with negotiating with an insurer over the value of their totaled vehicle. So to try to address some of those issues, we brought forward House Bill 2190, which essentially does three things. First, it increases transparency in the total loss process, which will give consumers necessary tools to make more informed decisions as they face a total loss. Second, it will increase the incentive for insurers to make fair and accurate vehicle valuations and settlement offers by requiring insurers to reimburse consumers for their reasonable appraisal costs when a final appraisal results in a greater valuation than the insurer's final offer. And finally, the bill will decrease the sense of urgency felt by consumers by requiring insurers to pay the undisputed amount of a vehicle's value while negotiations continue. So just want to give you a quick example on that. If an insurer is valuing a vehicle at $5,000, the consumer values the same vehicle at $7,000, this bill would require the insurer to pay the $5,000 up front while negotiations continue, just taking the pressure off of consumers a little bit. And I just want to go into a little more detail on these three provisions. First, as it relates to the transparency provision, The bill would essentially require insurers to provide vehicle owners with a written explanation of the methods used to determine the value of totaled vehicles. And additionally, it would require insurers to provide information to consumers addressing the questions that, quite frankly, our consumer advocates get most frequently, as basic as, what is a total loss? What happens if consumers and insurers disagree over the value of a vehicle? What rights do I as a consumer have? So some of those basic questions, we're envisioning this would be sort of an easy-to-read one-pager that insurers would provide to consumers that would just help them navigate the total loss process. With regard to the second provision of the bill that would increase the incentive for insurers to make fair and accurate settlement offers, when an insurance policy has provisions for resolving disputes through an appraisal process, and I say when because this bill doesn't require insurers to include in their policies an appraisal process, but when that process is included as part of the policy, the bill requires insurers to reimburse consumers the reasonable appraisal costs if, at the end of the day, the final appraisal decision is greater than the insurer's final offer. And I know there are some insurers, at least, that have considerable angst over this provision, and we've had discussions with them for a while about that. So I just want to provide the committee a little bit more context for this provision. I understand from conversations that we've had with insurers that very few claims get settled by going to the appraisal process. And in fact, during an investigation conducted by the division in 2005, two of Oregon's largest auto insurers reported that significantly less than 1% of claims were resolved using the full appraisal process. So again, the goal of this provision from our perspective is really to encourage insurers to make fair and accurate settlement offers so that claims are resolved before they ever get to the appraisal process and before that process is ever triggered. Finally, House Bill 2190 would decrease the sense of urgency felt by consumers faced with a total loss by requiring insurers to pay the undisputed amount up front and allow the consumer to continue negotiating the balance of the claim. We've heard some concern expressed about this provision as it's applied to third-party owners, and I just want to address that briefly. Third-party owners are vehicle owners who are not policyholders of the insurer. So, for example, if I crash into Chair Holvey's parked car and total it, Chair Holvey can come after my insurer and negotiate with my insurance company as a third-party owner. So that's the context that we're looking at here. And the concern that's been expressed, as I understand it anyway, is that the complexity of the comparative fault system, essentially determining liability, makes it difficult for the insurer to determine the undisputed amount. But the undisputed amount is essentially the insurer's offer. And that's really what we're talking about here. So presumably that offer is dependent upon the decision regarding liability. So until that liability decision is made, there wouldn't be an offer or an undisputed amount. And again, the entire reason for putting forward this provision from our perspective is really to decrease the sense of urgency that consumers face when they're dealing with a total loss. Whether that consumer is a policyholder or a third-party owner, the sense of urgency is there, it exists, and that's really why we put forward this provision. As I'm sure many of you know, the issue of total loss is one that the legislature has been wrestling with for a number of years, and I know you've also got House Bill 2370 on your agenda that you'll be looking at today as well. House Bill 2190 is really the division's attempt to address an issue that we feel is very important to Oregon consumers based on conversations that we've had with stakeholders over the last several months. Having said that, however the committee decides they want to proceed, I just want you to know that the division is here to assist you in those efforts. If the committee does decide to move forward with House Bill 2190, we would like to offer a few amendments based on the conversations that we have had with stakeholders, and we've discussed those with them, and I'd be happy to talk to the committee at the appropriate time about those, but I also am respectful of your time today. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Miller, since you mentioned House Bill 2370, would you care to comment on the difference between that bill and the proposed 2190 that your division has come forward with?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I'm probably the best person to do that. I was not personally involved in the conversations around that, and quite frankly, I haven't spent a lot of time looking at that bill, so there might be others in the room that could do a better job of commenting on that. I'm not sure I'm the best person.
So I give you the opportunity.
I appreciate that.
Questions from the committee? Everybody understands this one.
I love it. That's great.
So thank you for your testimony bringing this bill forward.
Mr. Chair, I think there might have been a question over there.
Oh, did I miss one? Question?
I was going to, but I already know the answer because I talked to Teresa in my office.
Oh, okay.
I was thinking we'd get it on the record, but we'll see her again. So we can go
sure
home.
You will.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony today. Next up, I'd like to have John Powell and Steve Merrill. Merrill. I thought it was a typo, but it was your handwriting.
It's mine.
Oh, that explains it.
I always wanted to be a doctor. That's the only thing that rubbed off.
I can relate.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, before you today, representing State Farm Insurance Companies.
Just a minute, Mr. Powell. I'd also like to open the public hearing on House Bill 2370, just in case you care to comment on it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to introduce Mr. Merle. Those of you who were on the committee last session saw a lot of us, and I felt sorry for you in many, many of those days. I started as an insurance agent a long time ago as a way to earn a living while serving as a legislator. It worked for a while, and then it quit working. And in those days, my cheekbones were high like Representative Barton, rather than the way they are today. I just want to say that Mr. Merle is an attorney in the claims office in Tigard and is a great resource on how insurance works and how the claims process works. And it can be confusing as you go from issues like total loss to personal injury protection benefits and those sorts of things. So we will try to, as best we can, be a resource to the committee. And I think those of you who were on the committee last session found that we try to work things out as we go along. There are always those issues where we can't, but for the most part, we try to meet with whoever it is that's introducing bills, and this is a good example, and the insurance division hosted meetings with us, and we appreciated that very much. We were pretty close to reaching an agreement on all things. There's just a couple items that remain. So with that introduction, Mr. Chairman, I would simply let Mr. Merle, who's handing you some information, at least some talking points you can scan while he's presenting, to talk about House Bill 2190.
Chair Holder, members of the committee, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney with State Farm Insurance Companies. I don't think, having been here since 2005, and each session had considerable total loss discussions, we can say total losses are not ever a problem, but I feel like the problem does need some perspective. State Farm alone, for probably the last 10 years, has averaged settling about 8,000 losses in the state of Oregon. We have about 18% of the market share in Oregon. I think if you extrapolate that out and say everybody has the same experience we have, you're looking at somewhere around 40,000 vehicles that would be totaled every year. Less than 1% of those end up with problems that go to the insurance division as a complaint. So as an industry, I think that you can see we do an effective job, but you know there may be room for improvement. In the bill that the division has crafted, we see two major problems that we would like to have addressed through amendment. The first one is in Section 3 of the bill that the administrator referred to as the advance payment of third parties. When you buy an insurance contract, typically an auto insurance contract, you might come to me and you might buy collision coverage, which would take care of your car when it gets in an accident. and I would pay you for it if it was a total loss. You'll also buy liability coverage, which protects you from claims that other people make against you when you hit their car and it's your fault that you hit them. When it comes to collision coverage, we would agree that if you're our customer and we're in a negotiation and we've made you an offer, that we should pay the undisputed amount. That has been the business practice of State Farm for many years. There are some amendments, I think, to Section 3 that the divisions have shared with us that are important to that working well, and that if we offer to pay you that undisputed amount, then you should go ahead and allow us to get the car out of storage so it's not collecting storage and running up expenses. You should transfer title documents to us. We can hold the vehicle for a while for you to have your people look at it for the dispute resolution purposes, but that vehicle should move through the process of having its second life as a recycled parts. But that's for if you're my customer. Now, if you're my customer and it's your fault that you damaged somebody else's vehicle, advance paying becomes very problematic. And the problem I've illustrated is in two examples I've given you in the outline. The first example I give is that you've got $25,000 worth of property damage coverage, which is a considerable amount of coverage. And both these examples, I'll preface, are extreme examples. And if they don't happen very often, but they do happen often enough that I see this kind of thing occur. Let's say that you already hit some sort of expensive vehicle, and the vehicle's value is maybe between $25,000 and $30,000. Under the division's bill, if we at least admitted that it had a $25,000 value, we would pay that to the person who owned that vehicle, but you would still be exposed to that additional $5,000 claim. In other words, there isn't a resolution. What you're paying for when you buy a liability insurance for me is to protect you, to go out and resolve that claim so it doesn't come back in litigation. And I should be able to do that by paying. The way the bill is crafted now, however, it would not do that. I would leave you exposed to potentially $5,000 or whatever other property damage claims this person has. A second example I gave you is maybe you have the same limits again, and you lose control, hit somebody's commercial van that's parked in front of a building, knock that van into the building, and the van is totaled. Now you've damaged tools that are in the van. Tools got stolen out of the van after the windows were compromised, and you've damaged the building. The example I drew here is, let's say $25,000 is what the van is worth. I would go ahead and pay for that van, advance pay under the current bill, and you would be exposed to that other $23,000 worth of damage that's out there. Now, that is conduct that in a case that I just handed out to you called Bolum versus Fireman's Fund, that Justice Gillette, when he was sitting on the Supreme or the Court of Appeals before he went to the Supreme Court, said an insurance company that advance pays to a third party like that and leaves their insured hanging without trying to resolve the claim and get closure is guilty of negligent conduct that they can be sued over. Now, if you pass this bill, that would be our statutory obligation. I don't think it could be characterized as negligent conduct, but I don't think it's a good idea. What we would prefer to see happen in the bill, and we've submitted what we have also shared with the insurance division is what we feel the fix is that, yes, we'll advance to first parties, but we should leave the tort system intact and protect our insurers by making sure those third-party claims reach resolution when they're paid and not have an advance payment without resolution. The final part of the bill that we have concern about is the part of the bill that's referred to as the appraisal section. And I want to make sure that when we're talking about appraisal, that there's some context to what we're talking about in appraisal and an insurance contract. Appraisal and insurance contract isn't that you go out and just get somebody to say, what is the vehicle worth? You do that, but it's a dispute resolution process. Typically, what you'll do is the insurance company will nominate their appraiser. The customer will nominate their appraiser. Those two agree on a person who is referred to as an umpire. Those three parties get together with all the information about the negotiations that have gone on to date. And they, two of the three of those, if they reach an agreement, then that becomes the value that the insurance company pays. Now that system is weighted against an insurer. And I say it's weighted against an insurer because it almost always ends up with a compromise that's more than what we offered. What prevents people from using that frivolously? Well, the insured pays for their own appraiser and they pay half the cost of the umpire. We pay for our own appraiser and half the cost of the umpire. And that's what today kind of puts a check into the system that's weighted against the insurance company on what the outcome is going to be. Under the division's proposal, the insurance company would pay all these expenses. And what we are concerned about is that generating a lot of, there's no downside to appraisal. I want an appraisal on every total loss. And you'll find people who do appraisals that will be soliciting that kind of business. And if you think that's a hollow statement, during this bad weather, I had a transmission of a draft back and forth on this bill, and I use Gmail at home. And some of you familiar with Gmail, it looks at what's in the text of what's being transmitted, and it'll produce advertisements on the top and on the side of things you might be interested in. Well, almost, I think all but one of the advertisements were, here's an appraiser that'll help you get more money for your insurance company. That kind of activity is going to kick up, and I just don't think it'll be good for consumers and insurers in the long run. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to start with example one under the advance payment. And am I correct that what you're saying is that if you made that advance payment, you would stop doing a negotiation? You would not go ahead and try to protect your client?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, the way insurance contracts have been drafted for years is just that result, that once you pay your limit for indemnity or the cost to pay a claim, you're discharged from any further duties. And there's a good reason for that, and the reason for it is if I stay there representing you, then the two parties never come down to where the rubber meets the road on reaching a resolution.
Follow up.
So if you don't pay that $25,000 in this case, and the agreement comes out to be $30,000, are you going to pay the $30,000?
Chair, hopefully, Representative Riley, no, we wouldn't pay the $30,000. What we would do, however, is we'd say, okay, we've got $25,000, that's all we have. In exchange for that $25,000, we want to discharge for our insured. And then the third party has to make a decision, do I want to litigate for five more thousand?
I don't see a difference. I'm sorry.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, I'm pretty sure I understood what you said, but in Section 3, you don't have any problem with paying the undisputed amount to the insured in first-party cases. You guys are perfectly okay with that.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, correct. We are perfectly okay with that. In fact, that's been State Farm's business practice for years.
Further questions? Comment?
Chair Holby, one thing I did forget to kind of explain to the committee that in the appraisal section, our suggestion is that instead of each party paying for their own appraiser and sharing the third party appraisal of half, is that we'd limit the shared expenses of the insured to $100. So we would provide an improvement in mitigating that expense for the insured, but we think it's important that they have something at stake if they go forward, and I forgot to mention that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm trying to get a handle on just that comment where you have a consumer who's been, Teresa Miller hit my car, as she explained, and you're her insurance company, and so I'm out of car. I don't have a heck of a lot of money because I don't really make a lot because my employer doesn't, I guess, think I'm worth more. So the question I have is you're going to limit, I have to then pay for the, you give me an offer and I'm going, geez, this isn't even real. Your offer isn't enough. And so I challenge that and get an appraiser, and they come back with this deal that says, well, in fact, it wasn't enough. But now I've had to defend the value of my car, essentially, to protect my limited financial resources. But yet the skin in the game for me is that I have to pay for my appraisal.
you know, I'm just, I'm having, a little hard time justifying that in my brain.
Well, Chair Holby,
can you help me justify that?
Chair Holby, I think the thing that to remember is appraisal is the extreme remedy. If you came back to me and you said, that isn't enough, I'd say, why? And we would go through a process of making sure, first of all, that I had the right kind of car, and, you know, as far as options and things, and maybe that you know some stuff about the car that we didn't know. And we would negotiate with you on that car. And as the administrator pointed out, a survey of a major insurer showed less than 1% of all these cases end up resolved through appraisal. So you have some negotiation you come back and do with us, and most of the cases get resolved that way. It's just that 1% that would end up in the situation you're talking about.
Well, being that 1% in my particular case, I don't know that that gives me any, you know, great relief.
Did you hand out the process, the rules that we have to go by?
I haven't done that, but Chair Holby, what we were just discussing is there's also an insurance regulation on the books that has a very detailed process today of how we evaluate total losses that gives us options on how an insurer can go about doing it. And essentially, following those guidelines, you're going to end up with values that are very close to being commercially reasonable on what a value is going to be. Those have been around for 20 years, and the reason I say 20 years, there's been refinement as those go along. The products that are used to evaluate have refined to where they're much better than what they have ever been. And as far as an accurate value, I think we get there.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, again, John Powell. The one thing that House Bill 2190 does is it requires that the insurer provide you, third party, with the information they received as a result of the regulation that requires us to use a vendor to come up with a value, to give you that documentation so that you would understand how that value came to be. And our proposed amendment would limit your exposure, if you wanted to go to appraisal, to a maximum of $100. So we tried to answer those questions in conjunction with the other provisions in the bill. Again, we believe we should give the third party that information on how the value came to be so that you can understand that better as a consumer. And anybody you have helping you, not punish the consumer with huge expenses on appraisal if they wanted to go to that, but to have a little bit of skin in that game.
It's my skin I'm worried about. What if I just do not come to an agreement with the appraisal amount, and you've offered me, you know, an amount for the loss value that, you know, that I guess you agree that Ms. Miller caused my car. So, and I don't agree with your value. Can I keep my car?
Sure. Hopefully, yes. You keep your just your car. Mm-hmm. You keep it.
Okay.
Now, the one of the things, too, that in example one, I chose a luxury vehicle. By and large, people that have that kind of vehicle are also going to have their own insurance where they're the customer. And if they couldn't reach agreement with me, coming to me as a third party, they would go to their own insurer. The provisions of the bill we agreed to, even if you had a dispute with your own insurer, we'd kick in to pay the undisputed amount, but it would happen through that side of the equation instead of through the third party insurance.
Would my insurer raise my rates because I made a claim on him at that point?
Chair Holby, I don't know because it depends on their rating plan, and those are different with every carrier.
I knew that was a loaded question.
You can bet on it.
Or Representative Matthews.
I don't know.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Gentlemen, I had a question about the advancement on a total vehicle, and I guess my question is, seems like cars are worth a whole lot more when you're calling to get the insurance on them than they are when they actually get totaled. So my question is, what is your current standard right now for totaling a vehicle? Is it a Kelley Blue Book? Is it a current fair market value? Is it a combination of all? Because in my experience, although I'm not the one that's totaled them, some friends of mine dealing with the issue, it always is, in fact, a dispute about I'm paying for a truck when I insured it that was worth $25,000, but now you're telling me it's worth $12,000. And so I'm curious what that standard is. If we're talking about protecting people, what's the standard on that?
Yeah, Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews, today it can be a combination of a number of things that would result in it being a total. Typically, what you're looking at is the repair bill compared to the value of the vehicle is not enough that would make it practical to repair it. Now, there are some other issues that lead into that. Repair time sometimes can take an awful long time. And that means that if it's going to take a long time, I need to give you a rental for that time. We may consider that into the equation, too, of whether or not that vehicle is a total. But typically, we'll run a value through one of the vendors, which the vendors use a database, which there's people in the room that explain to you how that works. That gets a value. We'll get an idea as to whether that vehicle is close to being a total. And then we'll make a judgment call.
All right, thank you.
Representative Barton.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass.
I'm glad you thought about that. So Representative Matthews brought up another issue that is a concept that's similar in a bill from the past that's been redrafted, House Bill 2370, which has a different look at establishing the value, which looks at the average retail of similar vehicles and establishing that value. Do you think a proposal like that would essentially mitigate a lot of the disagreement over the value of established by total loss?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, you kind of asked what I'll tell you what I see the difference between these two bills being. That one is a methodology for evaluation, and we prescribe the methodology for evaluation. I think the answer to your question is yes. A lot of the issues here go away. Now, I don't know that results in people being happy. 2370 has a methodology that's similar to something I've seen used in the state of New York. I think it's called Regulation 61 or something that was enacted there. That's how they settle is they use methodology similar to what you're talking about there. People dispute values in New York, too. What happens, though, are consumers are told, legislature says that way, and that's the end of the argument. So that it doesn't then become as much of a negotiated process. I'm not sure, in my way of thinking, that's harsher on consumers than being willing to listen to them and negotiate on that.
Mr. Chair?
Let Representative Krieger sure. Go first. He hasn't asked one on this subject yet.
Representative Matthews kind of brought up a thought. Paid $42,000 for a diesel pickup. It cost me $700 a year to insure it. I can understand 3 or 4 years down the line to replace the door, fix a window, regardless of the age of the vehicle, the cost is going to be the same. But now the vehicle is worth $12,000, but my premium for a total loss is still $700, but the value is only $12,000. So I'm paying 2 to 3 times compared to the original cost of replacing that vehicle. So if you total it, why was I paying the full $700 instead of that premium going down for the full replacement, which is no longer $42,000?
Chair, I'll be Representative Krieger. It's hard to answer that question without seeing your insurance bill because you're buying a variety of coverages. As the vehicle ages, its value is going to be less, and that's going to be reflected in the coverages that pay for the damage to the vehicle. In other words, your collision, your comprehensive coverage, if you're the insured. I have a 1993 vehicle that I drive to work every day that I shouldn't have coverage of a collision on if you ask anybody. The premium's so low on it, I just keep paying it because I'm a risk-averse person. But now the fact that your overall bill didn't go down is probably other factors influencing that. What we're paying for injury costs, what we're paying for personal injury protection costs, and those kinds of things.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Krieger, I just might add, due to my age, I've had automobiles that have aged, and I've watched that premium. And in fact, on the comprehensive collision, the premium has reduced over time. But as Mr. Merle pointed out, I've added another car, the kid driving, those sorts of things, and my premiums were high. But they did. And my 1987 Jeep Wrangler that I absolutely loved and kept until I gave it to a friend recently, I actually took the physical damage coverage off from it when it got to a value of about $2,500. But I would still have a premium that if I chose to keep that coverage, there'd be some premium there, because if I dinged the door and asked my insurance company to fix it, they would be obliged to if I had that coverage on it. So there would still be a premium attached to it.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I know that your example was hypothetical, but I just wanted you to know we think your service is just invaluable, but I'm pretty sure you're not getting a raise. For the slow learners, just give me the thumbnail again on what, in your amendment to this, what does undisputed mean? You can get there through an umpire, or a, what do we call them, a referee or an umpire?
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam. Undisputed in our amendment would just apply to my customer. If you're the State Farm customer and you have physical damage coverage, it would apply to you. When I come up with a value and I say this is the value, and you say, oh no, it's worth a lot more, my, what I've said the value is the undisputed amount, and I'll pay you that. Now, the amendments that we submitted and what the insurance division has shared with us would say is, if I'm going to do that now, you're going to let me move the vehicle out of storage so storage doesn't pile up. You're going to go ahead and transfer title documents so I can start the new life of salvage. I'll hold it for a while for you to look, have people look at it so we can go through the further evaluation process if you want to, but that's what it does.
We
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
But we reset agreement between client and insurance company. Right. You offered, I said, we talked, and I said, yeah, that's where we are.
That's correct. As far as we said, this is where it was, and you said, okay, I'll take the undisputed amount and give you this. Now, what we wouldn't be doing under this undisputed amount under our amendments is dealing with third parties who are non-customers.
Got it.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you brought up 2370 and asked the question about would this be a better way to value, I actually have a not hypothetical case. I was a third party with State Farm Insurance, and my insurance was different insurance. I had a total of car that, if this particular way of evaluating had been used, I would have gotten less money than I got. And the reason is, my particular car, I had just put on new tires, I had just put on a new top, it was a convertible. I had just had the entire undercarriage cleaned and undercoated and steam cleaned the engine compartment. State Farm took all that into account after evaluating, you know, looking at what's the normal value for this car. After I went back and said, hey, here are my bills, they didn't give me all of it, but I got some of it. And with this, I don't believe I would have gotten any of it.
Chair, only Representative Riley, that's a real-life example, and that's our experience also. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with the 2370 methodology is it using those types of evaluation, you find out that some people get dramatically underpaid while other people get overpaid.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is, it's just not specific to you enough, and because of that, I think there's less satisfaction with consumers.
Yeah, I wasn't satisfied, but I was more satisfied than I could have been.
I'm interested in why somebody your age has got a convertible.
Yeah. That's a good question.
You know, I think there's been a lot of questions brought up here that are worth talking about, for sure. I'm still struggling with Representative Krieger's issue of his insurance bill not going down as the value that he's going to recover if he gets in a wreck from the insurance company doesn't really match what he's paying for. And quite frankly, I've had that happen to me as well, where my insurance bill didn't go down over time and ended up in an accident and in a total loss situation, which I didn't believe it was totally a loss in the first place.
but the value was substantially less than what the value was when I established the insurance. And it was 5 or 6 years old, but my insurance premium never went down to accommodate that value. Is there a statute or requirement or some sort of a hidden rule somewhere that requires insurance companies to adjust those premiums down as their values are obviously dropping?
Well, Chair Holby, members of the committee, when we establish rates, they have to be actuarially sound. In other words, they have to reflect loss data. And so that's how we establish RECs. And that's the first check, is that our rate needs to be actuarially sound. So it reflects what loss data is out there on what's happening. And we do that specifically to your vehicle. Some vehicles are more expensive than others to repair. And when you have that first-party coverage, it does that. Now, the concern I have in just saying bills is that we're looking at your entire insurance bill, which is your liability insurance, too. And what we buy with liability insurance, a lot of that is healthcare, the damages that cause people. That's not gone down. And so typically what I see is physical damage coverages shrink over time, but those other coverages either grow or stay the same. So your entire bill stays the same. It's just the component. The other check you have out there is that State Farm has to worry about farmers. And if I'm not giving you a good enough price, and this is a competitive marketplace in Oregon, you're going to switch. And so I better be right, because there's somebody else willing to talk to you about giving another deal down the road.
I did switch, by the way. but it wasn't. You weren't originally. Well, make that clear. Anyway, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have asked Teresa this question when she was up here, and I was wondering if we could get her for a possible second.
We certainly can.
It's
the committee done with this panel? Any other questions for these gentlemen at this point?
Thank you.
I'm done.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming forward again. I appreciate your testimony in front of this committee.
I get older, they charge me more for health insurance.
And if I could have Teresa Miller back.
I was trying to remember the question, and for the life of me, I can't. So.
Well, I didn't ask you the question, so it's when you're finished. But I wanted to wait till you started coughing back there, too, before I called you up.
Thanks.
Teresa, what I was wondering, in dealing with this, do you find it's one particular company that you're getting more complaints about? I mean, is the industry overall good and it's one or two bad actors out there that maybe we just need to go and paddle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, for the record, Teresa Miller at the Insurance Division. It's a great question, and I'm going to have Cliff Nolan hit me if I say something wrong. But my understanding is from talking to our folks that actually a lot of the industry does a good job with these. There are some bad actors, but I think it's also an issue that we just hear about so much, and it is across the industry, but it's such a big consumer issue, and it is, as I said, the one issue that we hear about more than any other issue. So to not do anything from our perspective isn't really an option. We think something should be done to try and address that. And again, you know, we took a little different approach with 2190 that has been done in the past, just to try to get at those issues. Since that bill didn't progress, we thought, okay, let's try a new approach to try and get at those issues that we hear about from consumers. So a lot of the industry does a good job with this, with total loss, so I want to be clear about that, but I do think there's ways that we can improve the process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Real quick.
Representative Krieger.
Can I refresh my mind on the number of claims that we're dealing with? In other words, the vast majority seem to be working through the process pretty good, but we're getting, what is this percentage and number that we're dealing with that are...
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, are you referring to the appraisal piece of the... I'm trying to figure out if you're talking
probably
about...
Probably that piece.
The appraisal piece. So in 2005, I think I mentioned that we had done an investigation, and as part of that, two of the largest auto insurers had reported that significantly less than 1% of claims were resolved by using the full appraisal process. So the appraisal process is not something, as others have indicated, that is used very often. It's not.
Okay.
Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Miller? Thank you very much for staying through this so we could call you up again.
If I leave, does that mean I get out of coming back?
Not necessarily. Committee, looks like we're done discussing this particular issue. Oh, we had one more testimony, Sean Miller. Excuse me. Didn't mean to say we were done before you got your opportunity to talk.
You're done, I think. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. We are a national trade association made up of 1,000 members, 300 members in writing about 41% of the auto policies in Oregon. And just real briefly, I will be real brief because I don't have too much to add to what was Mr. Powell and Mr. Merrill said on House Bill 2190, other than when the bill last session was debated in this committee, and that was pretty much the identical language that is in 2370. A lot of the discussion that took place in that committee was transparency. If you know, I know the chair, the vice chair, and Representative Gilliam, who sat on that committee, we talked about transparency and understanding that valuation. Obviously, 2370, we felt, actually goes the opposite direction of no transparency, because we're talking about a take-it-or-leave-it number, whether it's a blue book or a NADA, a national book, a blue book, which is sometimes regional, and with no adjustments, as Representative Riley indicated. A lot of those adjustments are put on in the negotiating process, which actually benefits the consumer, especially in a state like Oregon, where SUVs, pickup trucks, those kind of items where people actually add things to their vehicles, those things are considered in the process. And so I think one of the reasons why, you know, again, I don't think that moved forward, but what we did following last session is the industry got together and said, okay, if the issue is transparency, then let's work with the division, try to come up with something to address that. We actually met with the division and started this discussion on this bill, 2190, in late December, I believe November, December of 2007, so following last session. We actually came forward with the notice provision and the paying the amount not in dispute. And so we actually came forward with those items to try to settle, again, with the notice provision and providing more transparency of understanding the process was very important. I think State Farm's draft amendments are deserve merit, because I think the issue that we'd like to still continue that discussion with the committee and the division is the third party versus first party issue, as well as the provisions on in section 4 of the bill dealing with the appraisal process. And you know, we do believe that that will foster more abuse in that process, even though it's a low percentage going there. We believe that can increase under this process, and so we want to continue that discussion. And in the interest of time, I will leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Miller, for your comments. Appreciate it. Didn't mean to overlook you on my list. I even saw you back there and knew you were on the list, so appreciate your comments, though. All right. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Miller as he's walking away?
Be quick.
Yeah. I didn't either. So.
One other hand.
We do have Mike Barber and Diane who did sign in to testify as well, and my committee administrator caught me before I totally ignored you. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Mike Barber. I'm Director of Regulatory Affairs for CCC Information Service. We provide vehicle valuations and automobile repair estimating systems to the insurance and auto repair industry. I'm here to talk about Bill 2370. our only concern with it is that it's not real clear what the impact of it would be. It indicates that valuation sources are to be specified by the Department of Insurance, which, based on some previous conversations with them and others, there's been an indication that they may have wanted to move to guidebooks as opposed to the current system that calls for local market valuations. And we've provided, or I've provided, some written comments for you folks. I won't try to repeat all of those. It was fairly lengthy. There are a couple things I would like to point out. My company's valuation process is a statistical database that's updated on a daily basis. It includes current data about real vehicles that are or were recently for sale in the marketplace as the basis for determining a vehicle's value. We also consider all the options and options that are purchased and put on a vehicle even after it was purchased. We call them additional considerations, as well as the condition of the vehicle, its mileage, and so forth. Those are prepared under existing Oregon regulations by the department that call for local market valuations. Our concern is that if the move is toward guidebooks, I would like to point out some of the things that we think are deficiencies and in which they lack transparency. The guidebooks are larger in geographic scope. They're not local market. Both NADA and Kelley, for example, on their newer cars are multiple states in scope as opposed to local market. And their older vehicle guides, which are over 7 or 8 years old, NADA is national in scope. Kelley is about 13 states west of the Mississippi River as opposed to local markets. In addition, they're not reflective of the particular vehicle, as I think has been pointed out in previous testimony, that we take into consideration every option that's on the vehicle, how it's, what its condition is, its mileage, and so forth. Further, there are a number of disclaimers which are pointed out in the material that we provided. They disclaim responsibility for the accuracy of their data. They also indicate that their values are based purely on the opinions of their editors. They give little information, if any, about how they actually determine a value other than that it's their opinion. Contrarily, our valuation reports are very lengthy, go into great detail, show the vehicle data that was used to determine the value, and so forth. So basically, in conclusion, we're merely concerned that if the bill's intent is to migrate toward guidebooks, we do not feel that that would be in the interests of consumers or insurers in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Diane Klund, and I work for Auditex, a Solera company. We also provide computerized total loss valuations in the state of Oregon, as well as the rest of the U.S. and Canada. Mike Barber basically took my testimony. We have the same concerns that CCC has. We have the same concerns that we've brought to the attention of this committee on several occasions in the past. And basically, while the bill does not specifically say Kelley Blue Book or NADA, if that is the intent of the department or the division, which has been expressed in the past, including testimony in front of this committee, it really goes contrary to what the theme has been with the division or conversations with the division to provide more transparency to consumers. The books allow basically a one- or two-line entry to determine the value of the car. As Representative Riley has stated in his particular claim, there are numerous items that are not taken into account. And the bottom line is these books were basically designed to provide an opinion or an average or a general guide as to what the ballpark might be on a vehicle, and adjustments need to be made from there. It's really not a tool for settling total losses. And also to echo what Mr. Barber said about the national guidebooks, based on our data and the 21,000 total loss valuations that we processed in Oregon last year, about 60% of those would come from a national guidebook. That includes Guam, it includes Alaska, it includes cars from Minnesota that spend 10 months in the snow and in the, in the salt. It really has nothing to do with the value of your car here in the Portland area or wherever in the state of Oregon. And again, to echo what Sean Miller stated earlier, it really gives you a take-it-or-leave-it approach to settling a total loss. This is the value. I think the philosophy or the thought had been in the past that that might help resolve complaints because the value is there in black and white, but it really doesn't give the consumer any leeway in negotiating their total loss with the insurance company. And again, to reinforce that the industry has provided some solutions to the division in the past, and many of those solutions have come out in 2190 that the division is working on with the industry. We would encourage this committee to go in that direction, working out those differences.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and it was valuable to hear you as well. So I appreciate that. Particular questions for these? Representative Krieger.
I have a question, I guess. 2 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, fuel was $2.40, $2.50, and went to $4 and something. So someone bought a vehicle at the time the fuel price was low, and then all of a sudden it goes up, and that vehicle on the lot, they were sitting on the lots by the thousands, and they couldn't move them. So during the time, that vehicle wouldn't have normally depreciated in value. But because of fuel costs, they were no longer in demand. So if something would have happened to that vehicle during that peak that we had at $4 or almost $5, for instance, for diesel, would have that person suffered a greater loss because the value of those vehicles was down if the vehicle was totaled?
Chair Holvey, Representative Krieger, you bring up a very good point. The guidebooks that are published, especially the national books, are only published quarterly. So, for example, the compact cars, which actually went up in value during that time frame, would not have been accounted for in the book values, whereas computerized databases, speaking for our company, that information is updated on a daily basis, inventory from dealerships, publications. So it's much more current to use a computerized valuation or computerized database than data that may be 4 months old in a publication.
And they just would have, excuse me, Mr. Chair, they would have just suffered a loss then simply because of circumstance of the economy that pushed the value of their vehicle down.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you know, making the effort to give us your opinion on this bill. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Committee, I'm going to close the public hearing. Gee, I almost forgot the name, bill number.
Yeah.
2370 and 2190. And with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2326. Victoria, if you could give us a brief summary of the bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2326 increases motor vehicle liability coverage required for property damage from $10,000 to $25,000 and certain personal injury protection benefits from $1,250 to $5,000 per week for lost income.
Thank you. Oh, my. I'd like to bring up Neil Jackson, Mark Nichols, and Robert Dalton. Thank you, gentlemen. If you'd identify yourself for the record before you begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, Representative Whitener, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. To my left is Robert Dalton. To my right is Mark Nichols. We are here on behalf of House Bill 2326, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Travel Lawyers Association. This bill does two things, and I'm going to try and talk fast, but understandably, because of the lateness of the day. Presently, law prescribes that the maximum benefit that you can be reimbursed per month when you're injured in an accident and you can't work is $1,250. Now, it's not that simple because there are three parts to it. You have to be off work for 14 days to qualify for wage or income replacement. And it depends on how much money you make at this time. You're entitled to receive 70% of your average weekly wage, but not more than $1,250 per month to replace your income if you're unable to work because you're injured in an accident. I will tell the committee that this limit was set 20 years ago in 1989. It hasn't been raised since then. And the reason we're bringing this bill is I'd also like to point out to the committee that if you calculate that out, that equals for a single individual, that's below minimum wage now, $7.20 an hour. And the problem that has come up, and my colleague Mr. Dalton and Mr. Nichols are here and they'll tell you about it. The problem is people are losing their homes because this is so low they can't afford to keep their mortgage up, pay electricity to feed their families. I want to point out and be specific about this. The upper limit is $5,000. If you make a salary, you're injured, you can't work. If you make a salary of $3,000 per month, you don't get $5,000 from your PIP benefits. What you get is 70% of the $3,000. So in that situation, you would get $2,100 a month net. The reason it's set at 70% is to take into account taxes that are taken out of your gross salary every month. That's why it's set at 70%. So in my scenario, someone's making $3,000 a month. They can't work. Their doctors have taken them off work. They would get 70% of that $3,000 to try and keep their household going. I would also point out that the $1,250 a month is far below the poverty level for a family of four. We wanted to make sure that we researched this because we expected the opponents to come up and tell you that it was going to shoot premiums through the roof. My colleague, Mr. Dalton, researched it through his agent, to his State Farm agent, who went back east and made the phone calls. He was told that the cost per month for increase to this amount with this upper limit would be $6 for 6 months. In other words, a dollar a month. That's how much it would cost. The second part of this bill has to do, and this, frankly, the second part of this bill was suggested to me last session by my friend, Mr. Miller from State Farm. Right now, we have a $10,000 minimum property damage liability requirement in the state of Oregon. Very simply, what that means, if when Teresa Miller crashes into Representative Hovey's car, if she has a minimum policy, she only has $10,000 coverage. Okay, that $10,000 coverage has been in effect for 24 years, and it hasn't been raised since then. The cost to repair vehicles, it's not uncommon for it to exceed $10,000. When you add in the rental charges, which Steve spoke about earlier, the rental charges have to be taken into account, and other property damage like crashing into the building, plus the cost of the vehicles, what vehicles cost today. We just think that $25,000 is much more reasonable. Now, I can't tell you what it'll cost me to increase mine to $25,000 because I already have $25,000. But I can tell you when I look at my deck sheet, and this is very common, look at your own, maybe it's different with your policy, but when the declaration sheet is what tells you how much your coverage is and how much your premium is, when you look at your deck sheet, maybe yours will say the same thing mine does. When it's got property damage liability, zero. There's no amount there. Now, I know I'm paying something for that, but it doesn't give me an amount as to how much it is, so I can't project to you what this increase would do in terms of premium, but I doubt it would be extensive. I'll also point out to you another thing. I've talked to you about how long it's been. In 1983, $10,000, I ran the CPI, $10,000 purchased what now? $19,927 purchases. So it's time to raise this. I would invite you to ask the opponents how much it's going to cost. We did our research. That's what we came up with. And if there are no questions, we can move whichever way you want.
Why don't we listen to all three of you, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Dalton. I'd like to introduce my client now, Mr. Mark Nichols. He is, in fact, is a victim of a car accident, and he's going to tell you what effect the $1,250 limit has had on his life.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Mark Nichols. On January 15th of last year, I was on my way to Providence Medical to pick up a next door neighbor, and I was rear-ended by a 24-foot box van, a Providence Medical truck. Well, I was knocked out at the scene. It totaled my vehicle. Before that time, I had just gotten to the point where all of my bills were caught up except for my house payment, obviously, but for the first time in my life, I had actually started putting money in savings. Since this accident, I've had the disc replaced in my neck, which at that time, that was back in April, and I wasn't able to work for 3 to 4 months. After that time, I was fighting with the insurance company to have my shoulder worked on because it completely tore the rotator cuff of my shoulder, and I finally got that resolved enough to where I ended up having to pay money out of my pocket to get the shoulder surgery done. And in that meantime, my PIP coverage was completely used up by my neck surgery, and I still haven't received a dime from anyone. I don't know exactly how I'm going to keep going with all of this. I mean, fortunately, I had a little bit of savings that I had accumulated, so we've used that to try to keep going, but I've also incurred over $12,000 on my credit cards. And at this point, I mean, my house payment is $1,531 a month. Well, $1,250 doesn't even cover that, let alone actually making it. So right now, I'm to the point where just about all of my resources are used up, and it's getting really close to where either I'm going to have to, you know, try to take out another loan, which I actually can't because I'm as far as I can go on my house right now, and it's not going to work. So, you know, I come to you telling you my situation, and this $1,250 a month that's out there right now doesn't even cover my house payment. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I practice law in Clackamas, Oregon, and virtually all of my practice is representing people like Mr. Nichols. I've been doing it out in that area for about 15 years. When I first started practicing, as I did my intake, I'd be talking to my client, and not often, but once in a while, they would have injuries severe enough that their doctor had recommended that they be off work. When I first started practicing in this area 15 years ago, it was very rare that any of my clients would say to me, "Oh my God, how am I going to live on $1,250 a month?" Over the years, that's about the first thing I hear. It is shocking to people that we have allowed this number to become a virtually meaningless benefit for folks who are relying on their insurance policy. When they look at the broad language of their policy, it says, if I'm in an accident, my wages are going to be covered, I'm going to receive reimbursement of my wages, and I'm also going to have my medical bills covered. In fact, by not raising it for all these years, we've made that an illusion, and people cannot live on the number that's in that statute currently. I'd like you to tell you one story of one such family. My client wanted to be here, but he's a painting contractor, and you may have noticed it didn't rain today. He was out working. Good for him. He's a father of two, married, owns his own home in southeast Portland. As a painting contractor, he was making take-home. And understand that that's the issue. It's take-home pay. It's not gross earnings that we're looking at here. His take-home was about $2,500 a month. And the family was getting by on that. They were able to make their mortgage payment. They were able to live a reasonably good life. But they were not fat by any means, and they didn't have savings. Last fall, he was in a car accident. And as a result of the impact, his head hit the window and he was knocked out also at the scene. But he went on to develop some pretty severe upper back problems and some balance problems, which affected his ability to work overhead. Obviously, he could not continue as a painting contractor for a period of time. His doctor got him into therapy. They took him off work. The family actually had their house put into foreclosure. Because of the inability to get his $2,500 a month from his business, he found himself in a situation where the family was unable to meet their obligations. He was the sole breadwinner for a family of four on $2,500 a month, and there just wasn't any savings. So what we're asking here in asking you to support this bill is to introduce some fairness and to ask the law to live up to the contract that we've made in allowing auto insurance. We've told people that if they have insurance, they're going to be covered for certain things in the event of an accident. As a society, we're going to be covered if they cause an accident. But as to the individual, I submit we are failing. We're failing to provide Oregon families with the protection that they think they're getting from our auto insurance. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Toomey.
Could I just point out that in our vote explanation, bill explanation, it says $1,250 to $5,000 per week. I just want to make sure that's corrected.
Thank you for catching that.
That's an error. It's per month.
I realize that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reading very carefully. That would have been a healthy amount.
Yes.
Are we going back to legislative wages?
So in reading this proposal, I notice in subsection C of section of the first section, or paragraph C, I guess, of subsection 1 of section 1, that there's a maximum penalty of $30 per day, and that one isn't being proposed to be changed along with that. I'm just kind of curious as to what the thinking of...
We take little bites. Chairman and members of the committee, Neil Jackson. Every time we try and raise any of these things, and we decided this year to take smaller bites because we've been shot down for the last two sessions. That's why the committee wants to raise that and bring that more reasonable. Hey, we're there.
I was just wondering if there was a reason why it should or shouldn't be raised. Just a choice of the of whoever was sponsoring the bill, I assume, is what from what you're saying. Okay, questions from the committee for these gentlemen? Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, actually, if I may be heard, I actually unfortunately have to leave. The speakers just pulled me out. But before I did, I just wanted to thank the witnesses for coming in today. I genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barton. I think you've laid out a pretty straightforward presentation. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you coming and testifying on this issue. Next up, we have John Miller, John Powell, and Steve Merle. And Mr. Merle, I think John Powell's penmanship got better maybe after the first go-around.
It's a sedative.
So, if you would introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Steve Merle. Again, I'm an attorney for State Farm Insurance Companies. House Bill 2326, kind of as described, addresses two different portions of Oregon law affecting automobile insurance. The first part of the bill affects personal injury protection insurance, commonly referred to as PIP, and if I slide into it, that's what I'm talking about, is personal injury protection coverage. That coverage is a coverage that came onto all insurance policies issued or renewed in Oregon in the 1970s. The purpose of that coverage is to provide you some sort of medical benefit. Today, the medical benefit is $15,000 that helps pay the first responders the immediate medical bills that you have. It also, if you are injured and you are a working person, it will provide a wage loss benefit. That wage loss benefit today is $1,250 per month. It also, if you're not working and you provide household services for your family and aren't able to provide those any longer and have to hire somebody outside the household to come in and do that, it'll pay up to $30 a day for replacement of those services. Now, you either get wage loss or you get household help. It's just one or the other from just historically how they structured the bill. It also pays a funeral benefit. The funeral benefit is $5,000 a day. In 2005, we raised the medical benefit to $15,000, the funeral benefit to $5,000. The medical benefit was a an attempt at a pro-consumer project, and what we did is raising the medical benefit to $15,000, the amount that a provider can charge somebody who receives this coverage is now tied to the workers' compensation fee schedule. So you keep that tension going. That hopefully that $15,000 goes further for the consumer. And the insurance industry came up with that idea and passed that in 2005. What we're talking about today in that part of the bill, the personal injury protection part, is raising the wage loss benefit. Now, the wage loss benefit works in that you get 70% of your current salary up to $1,250 a month. When we pay that benefit to you under current IRS regulations, you're not liable for any taxes. That's why it's 70%. Is it kind of makes it like what you would net when you come home after taxes. That amount today is $21,428 if 70% of your income comes down to exactly $1,250. January 1, this body had the minimum wage go up to $8.40. My calculations are that if you are able to get a minimum wage job that has 40 hours a week, you work all 52 weeks, you'll earn $17,472 for the year. So it does cover minimum wage people. The concern I have with this bill is that in raising it to $5,000 for everyone, you have to have $5,000 worth of coverage. If you do the math, in order to net $5,000, you have to be a person who makes $85,000 plus a year to net that amount. And what we're doing by saying that everyone has this coverage is that the minimum wage person who buys auto insurance is also going to pay for that enhanced benefit, even though they'll never get it. My concern is that if you were wanting, you were interested in raising benefits for people who are situated where they're above the $1,250 amount, a more rational approach would be to say insurers need to offer increased amounts and to tie those increased amounts to specific people. Today, everyone in the car has wage loss coverage, whether you're insured with me or not, just by virtue of your riding in the car. But people should be able to gauge their own risk and say, I need an enhanced benefit. Now, if you raise it to $5,000, I wouldn't buy it. I would keep it at $1,250. And the reason for that is, where I'm situated, I have enough sick leave, disability insurance that I buy through my work. I don't need this benefit, and I should be able to make that choice. But I think you find out that people that make $85,000 a year are more situated like that than people who are down to $17,500 part of the spectrum. So I, you know, if the wage benefit, if the body wants to increase it, I would recommend doing it and saying it's offered. Now, how much does it cost? Mr. Jackson testified that he found out how much it would cost. This is a product that doesn't exist. And I don't. There may be some confusion about the information he got because I have access to the people who create the pricing for this product, and I haven't got a response from them on how much it would cost to increase it to $5,000. I will tell you, as an industry, as I watch the products and the coverages that are under price pressure, this personal injury protection coverage is under price pressure in Oregon. We're looking at the costs are going up for that, and we're looking at the possibility of rate need. The second part of the bill deals with raising the financial responsibility liability insurance limits. What that is that in Oregon, we have decided as citizens that if you're going to drive a car on the street, you need to be financially responsible. You hurt somebody, there needs to be some low level of coverage that you have that takes care of those claims that are put against you. That's the financial responsibility law limits. We commonly call that FR, and I apologize if I slide into my speech of calling it FR law, but that's the law. That's what we are saying as a society in Oregon is the minimum amount that's financially responsible to have to pay somebody's claims with. Currently today, it's at $10,000 for property damage. That's the component that is being proposed to be raised. I've handed out a sheet, or I gave it to the committee administrator, that kind of shows in 2005 what the level of property damage limits across the nation were. Now, I don't have more current information. I'm trying to get more current information. I don't think there's been too much change. The bulk of states were either at $10,000 or below. You have another tier that's at $15,000, and then a bigger tier that's at $25,000. They say that's what's financially responsible to drive. When we're looking at raising those limits, the extreme cases that I described to you in the previous testimony I had today, I don't think that's the way that's to look at it. What we should look at it is, what is the financially responsible amount that we say you have to have? Because when we're saying that, we're also saying this is what you have to pay for insurance. And I'm concerned about people who don't have a lot of money being able to purchase coverage. How much will it cost to go from $10,000 to $25,000 with State Farm? Not too much. It's a very nominal amount. However, State Farm has very few people in our book of business that have $10,000 worth of coverage, the minimum. The clientele we have tends to be people who have more to protect. Our agents advise them about what they need to protect, and they buy more. A few years ago, I talked to an insurance agent that insured high-risk people, trying to find out what the pricing for that was. I could not find out, and the reason I could not find out is they don't sell any other product. They just sell the minimum. That's all you can have. So if you want to raise that, that's the concern I have, the tension of, are you going to knock some people out of the market and have them be uninsured? I think Mr. Miller has some data he'll share with you on that that's come out recently. The other tension I have is, how much are we going to say, if you want to raise it, where should that go? I'm not sure $25,000, if you want to raise this, where you go. $15,000 might be a more rational place to go. I will share with you the average property damage claim in the industry today is somewhere between $2,500 and $2,750 on a property damage claim. So today, $10,000 is going to take care of the average claim when you're telling somebody to be financially responsible. It will not take care of the extreme cases where you have a lot of damage. With that, if there's any questions from the committee, I'd be more than happy to answer them or let Mr. Miller testify, your choice.
I think we'll listen to the rest of the testimony first, please.
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association. Again, 300 members that do business in the state of Oregon. And I just want to touch on a few points of my testimony, which I handed out to the committee. And you know, our concern with House Bill 2326 is its increase in claim costs, which correspond to rate increases. Obviously, an increase in uninsured motorist driving in Oregon could be a result. I did hand out a Wall Street Journal article attached to my testimony that talks about a correlation between every 1 point of increase in the unemployment rate. There is a corresponding 0.5% increase in the uninsured drivers. And so cost is obviously a driver to low-income individuals. If that may increase, you're going to see more and more people drop off and be uninsured, which is not safe on our roads. This bill would have, as Steve indicated, a disproportionate adverse impact on low-income individuals. And just to touch on that a little further, I know Steve didn't touch on some of the price impacts, but as Steve indicated, the $5,000 per month in the PIP wage disability benefit, 70% of that, the income level will be $85,000. To a reasonable person, that's an income bracket that I can afford the higher premium.
contrary to that, when I've asked some of my companies what kind of benefits or what kind of increases are we talking about to some of the lower income individuals, and I did get back some. A leading national insurance writer currently charges a premium and does offer the $5,000 worth of wage loss benefits, and the result of their rate was 52% higher in the wage loss benefit for the $5,000 price versus the $1,250 minimum. And I will point out that the $1,250, you know, it really is a statutory minimum because even though it does say maximum in the statute, you know, ORS 742532 allows PIP carriers to provide benefits more favorable than the statutory language. So, again, what Steve mentioned is some kind of an optional approach, I think, is a benefit to those maybe higher income levels, but not, hurting those at the low income level, which I think this bill has to touch on. And with that, I think I'll just conclude my remarks, Mr. Chair, and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, I just end by maybe a PIP primer on personal injury protection. It was added to the law in 1973 as a no-fault system, not as a replacement for other types of insurance. And the no-fault basis is if you're injured in an automobile accident and the people in your car, your passengers, are also injured, they all have this protection all at the same time. It's not a protection that just protects the person who buys the insurance. If you hit a pedestrian, this applies to that pedestrian. So the goal of PIP was to put a low cost, and in those hearings, there was the insurance commissioner was cautioning the committee to keep this as a low cost program, not to replace other lines of insurance like life insurance or disability insurance, but to help the consumer get through this period right after an automobile accident. And so the benefits were designed to be modest and not overly burdensome to the purchaser of insurance. And so I just wanted to end with that primer as to why this little bundle of packages exist. Now, once liability is established, the insurance companies subrogate and they settle all this out. So if my insurance company paid for my medical and some wage loss and it was determined that the other party was at fault, my insurance company would subrogate and get that money back. So, again, this was a quote, no-fault portion of your insurance policy, and everyone must buy this. The law says everybody will buy auto insurance if you're going to drive, and the law says you have to buy this coverage. You can't buy it without it. In some states, like Washington, the medical part of your policy is optional. You don't have to have medical payments in the state of Washington. You opt out because of pricing and trying to keep people in the market. So I just question you again against raising these levels to almost a totally different policy level of a disability policy that you would buy to protect you in the case you couldn't work.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, a quick question. In your testimony, you indicated that you found one carrier that did offer the $5,000. It was a 52% increase. Do you have that information in dollar terms? What was the dollar price that you're basing that 52%?
I do, Mr. Chairman. The dollar percent, and I did include that. It should be included in my testimony, but I believe it's an $80 versus $144.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
I haven't had time to read it, so. Further questions, Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Powell, you mentioned something about a pedestrian, and the pedestrian would also be covered if you hit that pedestrian. And last year, we had some bills that really made some liability to vehicle operators in the event they hit a bicyclist. The spandex boys, what I call them, with their skull caps. And I was opposed to that because what I've experienced is that a lot of these adult, more than kids, adult bicycle riders are causing accidents and jeopardizing vehicle insurers. So if I hit a motorcyclist who caused the accident, my insurance is going to reimburse him. Anybody?
Chair, Representative Krieger. A motorcyclist, no. But a bicyclist under, for the PIP statutes is classified as a pedestrian. So your coverage would apply to him. However, I'm a boy in spandex. I don't want to incur your wrath, and I try to follow the rules of the road so I don't give people a bad name that ride bikes. But if I get hit by a car, my own personal injury protection coverage is primary. That's the one that takes place first.
Okay.
When I use that up, it goes to my health insurance. And your personal injury protection coverage is the last in line for me. And the same is true with a pedestrian. So the only time that your coverage would end up being primary for that person is if they had no other alternative.
Follow up. I've got a bill that's coming forward to license bicycles require liability insurance. You think that's a good idea?
I'm sorry.
You think that's a good idea?
Chair Holby, Representative Krieger, I don't think it's a good idea. Licensing, not so much as it, if I hit your car today, and it's my fault, I have insurance. I have homeowner's insurance, and it'll take care of that. If you require me to have bicycle-specific insurance, there's a cost in setting up a policy and a cost in marketing that that's going to make that more expensive for me. So I'm covered for my liability today. What you would be doing, though, is increasing my expense. Licensing is another issue. I don't really have an opinion on that.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
If you're not a homeowner and you're renting, does the renter's policy then cover that client?
Chair Holley, Representative Krieger, yes. If he has renter's insurance, that would be the same place.
Thank you.
What if he doesn't have renter's insurance?
Actually, over then, he doesn't have anything that I know of that would take care of it.
Mr. Chairman, I might just state for the record that what Mr. Merle needs in terms of bicycles is not a license. He needs studded tires because a few years ago when he lived in Eugene, on an icy morning, there was no traction, and he went straight to the hospital and severed and compound fractures and ugly stuff. So.
Chair Holby probably knows the right word. There's a little seep that comes out not too far from Skinner's cabin that gets across the trail and freezes sometime, and that's the spot. So.
I hate to admit I've had that problem on a summer dry day, so I gave up bicycles at the suggestion of the police. Representative Widener.
I hope it wasn't because you were in spandex when you're riding your bike.
No, I didn't know what spandex was.
So, quick question regarding this now, because this is basically a pedestrian getting hit by an insured motorist. You're only right now, basically, it's $12.50 a month, and then I would be relying on if I had Aflac or something like that to cover me after that.
Chair, hopefully, Representative Wagner, that's correct. You would, but it's not confined to pedestrians either. Pedestrians are one of the class of people that's covered. But also, if you were a passenger or a driver in a car, you have this coverage.
But your liability coverages would cover you if you hit the bicycle.
If it's your fault, that's what I'm getting at. So I'm walking down the street, and your insured pulls over and hits me. Mm-hmm. I make $150,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I'm only going to get $12.50 is what I'm hearing.
Chair Holby, Representative White, from the auto insurance, that's for the no-fault person, portion of the auto insurance, that's correct. Now, that person's also going to have liability insurance, so you're going to make a claim for any wage loss that wasn't compensated by the personal injury protection coverage.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I just might add, liability insurance is also a required coverage. Yeah, you can't buy an insurance policy with just PIP.
you have to have liability coverages as well to a minimum limit. So there would be liability coverage if the person was insured to take care of those costs above these limits. You'd make a claim for your wage loss.
Thank you. I kind of like to. I have two more people to testify that have signed up, and I know there may be some more questions.
I can hold.
If you could, we'll have another opportunity on this bill. And if you do have questions of people that have testified, I think we have all their contact information. I hope we do anyway. So next up, I'd like to have Lana Butterfield and Jeannie Stocker.
Can we close the hearing on Representative Krieger's bill?
Yeah, I really don't want to talk about his bill anymore. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho, or PIA, as we call ourselves. PIA is a statewide trade association of independent insurance agents who sell for more than one company, and you undoubtedly have some independent agents in your own district. I brought someone who sells high-risk insurance with me today. But before I ask her to speak, just as I was leaving, I happened to see a new study that is out, and I will give you a copy of this. I was only able to make one copy, but it's a new study, apparently. This is just a press release, and you have to order this study, but it's from the Insurance Research Council, and it says that approximately 1 in 6 drivers across the U.S. may be driving uninsured by 2010, and they cite the recent economic downturn is expected to trigger a sharp rise in the uninsured motorist rate. So if you're interested in that, I can offer you this as a resource. But I'd like to turn it over now to Jeannie Stocker.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeannie Stocker. I work for Acclaim Auto Insurance in Salem, and I'm here representing the professional, the PIA of Oregon. You know, as an insurance agent, and I, as a regional manager for Acclaim Auto Insurance, we service a lot of the high-risk, non-standard insurance clients. They're coming in primarily looking for a personal auto policy. Many of these people are low-income and have a really hard time paying for insurance premiums as it is. The mandatory increases, though initially, you know, some of the testimony that I heard was is that, you know, the it's not really sure how much the increase would be to your rates. As claims start to come in, that's the part that starts to worry us the most, that the increases would keep happening. We're opposed to the House Bill 2326, mainly because of its disproportionate effect to those low-income clients. Their increase in premiums would, in fact, subsidize somebody who was making $85,000 a year. You know, under the bill, most of these low-income clients would be paying for additional premium with no extra benefit for them at all. They, you know, many of them make less than the $12.50 per month, and so it seems a little, you know, unjust for them to have to subsidize somebody who would make that kind of money when there would be no benefit to them at all. And so, I mean, for us, we're in opposition, you know, of the bill, and we're asking that you vote no. I thank you for your opportunity to testify.
Thank you for that, and we're not voting today. Any questions for this panel? Representative Matthews.
I have a question, I guess, and you just happen to be sitting in the seat. It's probably for everybody representing insurance at this point. And that has, first of all, we keep hearing about economic downturn and how this rate increase would perhaps drive people to drive uninsured. I think when people start learning a little more about their insurance, how it's not going to help them, that's going to be a big risk. The question I have for you is, you said subsidizing $85,000 a year and a person making the lowest income or poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you take into account somebody's earnings? when you're writing their policy, just as if I were to drive a $1,200 car, I wouldn't be insuring somebody else's $50,000 car. Wouldn't you take into account my ability to earn in terms of the rate itself, so that if I could earn $3,000 a month, I'd be rated at that, and not just say that everybody's going to be rated at $5,000? That seems pretty irresponsible. Couldn't we do something with that? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, I think what you're getting at is maybe, is it more on the optional side, the doing something to kind of be in between the 1250 and the...
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Yeah, well, what I'm getting at here is that not everybody involved with this PIP would qualify for $5,000. The only people that would get that would be the rare case that somebody's making $85,000. But we're using that as the tactic to say, this is bad because everybody is going to have the right to this money, where actually it's only going to be those that are injured. And I guess, not to talk hypothetically, but I don't know how anybody can sit in good conscience knowing, as Mr. Nichols, I think it was, testified over a year ago, he was in an accident, has yet to be paid for that claim, and he's only at $1,250. People are losing their homes and things over this sort of situation. So I'm just asking, would things be based on income to be prorated so that if somebody was, when they get insurance, and you get a lot of information when they do, if they're only making $2,500 a month, that's the most they'd ever be rated at in terms that they needed this insurance policy. Do you understand what I'm saying now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, income level really doesn't play a factor in insurance rates at all. And that's what you're referring to, correct? I think maybe it would be nice if, you know, say somebody who was making lower income what made less, but in essence, the personal injury protection is a really large portion of your insurance rates in general. I mean, it can be, for some of the high-risk clients, it can be as much as a quarter to a third of the insurance premium, and so it doesn't really have any kind of income determination. I think that it would be difficult to get that information up front, even as an insurance agent. You know, I'd have to evaluate all of my clients and their ability and their income level in order to determine the rates that they would get.
Aren't you doing that now in terms of the vehicle they drive, the members of the household, potential drivers of the vehicle, and everything else considered when you look at the policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, you know, since I work as an insurance agent, I can't speak to all of the things that go into rates, but a lot of it has to do with your particular driving record, has to do with your credit score, has to do with the vehicle that you drive, and I know that the information is based in large part on, you know, the claim history in your particular age bracket.
That's fine. I'll Representative Matthews, I think Mr. Powell wanted to take a shot at this, and we'll make it very short because we're going to adjourn right after this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, the difference between the value of the automobile, which is fairly easy to determine, is that PIP applies to people who are not party to the insurance contract. If I give you a ride across town, you're getting PIP coverage under my automobile insurance policy. So I can't know the income of the people. Same with pedestrians, so it can't be sold that way because in that PIP primer, it was a kind of a ball of benefits to not treat the long term, but the short term expenses that are involved, and not to displace policies like disability policies, which are in fact rated based on your age, and you can only buy up so high based on your income, so that you don't over-insure and create a fraud hazard of somebody being able to make more by not working than working. So That's why you couldn't write this type of coverage that way.
Do you mind? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. I'm intrigued.
And I guess then what I would say is perhaps I misunderstood or was even misled, although I don't want to make that accusation, as Mr. Merrill made the comment that he would opt out of this coverage. He would not need it for himself, and he would not, you know, accede to that with his own personal situation because $1,250 would be fine for him to get by. So I guess my assumption was, in his case, I mean, you know, it's not the passenger that opts for the coverage, it's the actual insured themselves.
Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, what Mr. Merle had suggested if the committee has an interest in increasing the availability of higher limits in here, that it become optional, and that you require an insurance company to offer to you an amount maybe up to $5,000 in income replacement coverage. And the comment about turning it down is that I believe he said he had disability insurance for this purpose, and so he would actually have double coverage and he wouldn't be able to collect both. The problem with relying on PIP is that it would be primary, paid before a disability policy. So the expense in the auto policy would be there, notwithstanding the fact that a lot of people who make $85,000 a year do insure for disability or have a leave policy at work where they may have benefits up to a year of paid leave. So I think that was the point he was trying to make.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Ripson Cowan.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you can help me understand just where in the spectrum of coverage PIP falls. Let me tell you what my thinking is. I'm an average insured person, and I drive with automobile insurance. And if I rear end your vehicle and I'm an at-fault driver, isn't there more in my coverage that takes care of the damages to you besides just PIP? Isn't that sort of a fallback when you kind of fall through the cracks, so to speak, on other things? I mean, surely all that money I pay on an annual basis, I'm paying for something that's going to pay for your medical expenses, and I don't know if there's wage replacement in that or not. So I'm just trying to understand insurance coverage in general a bit better.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cowan, you're correct. These coverages are bundled. The PIP coverages that were discussed earlier today, property damage, coverages, damage you do to other people's vehicles, and a liability portion to protect you against all harm you might cause someone. So it is a package of those benefits, of which PIP is exactly as you portrayed it. It is a bundle of things to help you get by, not designed to provide total replacement for health insurance, life insurance, or disability insurance.
Well, just quickly, I see the clock.
She's been real quiet today.
I've been very quiet.
I know you have. I've already violated my goals.
That's okay.
Here,
but I'll pass. But
I want you to ask this question. So.
Are you sure?
Eagerly waiting.
I do.
Well, I'm not looking so much at medical, life, all of those other issues. I'm trying to understand the damaged parties' right to collect, and I carry all this liability stuff on my policy. Surely it's going to do more than get to the PIP coverage. Isn't my policy going to cover your medical expenses, and is it going to cover any of your wage loss because you can't work after I hurt you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan, and that's why I in my PIP primer, tried to point out the fact that if somebody runs into you and you've collected under your own PIP, and maybe they've collected under their PIP, when fault is finally determined in that case, the at-fault liability insurance will cover, and there will be this carrier who your insurer, you weren't at fault, somebody hit you, will be able to recover the money that they paid out because they weren't at fault for this. So they subrogate. And the total cost of that exposure then is addressed by your limits, liability limits in your insurance policy. So that's why we said most people carry more than these minimum limits. The $10,000 property damage, and that sort of thing. Most people buy more than that because they know their exposure is there, and they don't want to pay out of their own pocket. They want their insurance policy to be large enough to take care of that. Some people can't afford that high coverages.
I understand.
But
thank you.
You're right. It is there. You would have more protection than just PIP to cover the losses in a situation like this.
Thank you. I still sometimes am troubled why one of the biggest industries in the world is so complicated and complex when really we're just looking for some real basic, you know, coverages. But anyway, just commentary on off the side of the, you know. With that, I am going to appreciate your testimony as well. I'm going to close the committee hearing on House Bill 2326 in committee. Oh.
No, that's fine. I just, before you close the meeting, I'd like to say something.
No, I haven't closed the meeting yet. I haven't adjourned. I'm just closing the public hearing. Committee, I appreciate your indulgence in going late tonight and last Friday. We are not going to have a meeting on Friday in this committee, so I decided to let you know that. But I would appreciate it if all that we've had this large barrage of bills, you take a look at these bills, you come up with the questions you have on these bills, contact whoever you want to contact to try to get your questions answered. And when we come back and have our next set of public hearings on these bills, I hope to have a little bit more resolved points of views on these issues, perhaps. I'm not saying we will, just kind of a goal.
Be nice.
So, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we allow our good colleague, who I think had an excused absence during the vote on the lighter bill, could we allow him to vote on that?
Certainly we can. Thank you for that suggestion. So I think I have to open the work session back up for that, and the bill number was
2365.
I'd like to reopen the work session on House Bill 2365. And Representative Gilliam, do you have any objections to the due pass recommendation to the floor on House Bill 2365?
I have no objections.
Let the record reflect that. Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2365. And Representative Tomei, thank you for bringing that up. Oftentimes a courtesy we sometimes forget early in session.
Why did this stay in his chair?
No, I'm not going to tell him that. Sometimes I like him to get up.
To leave, yeah.
With that, I'd like to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
There we go.